Chapter 4. There were no further attempted attacks on the line, but it was long after dark when the little lakeside town was reached. The station master was summoned from his cottage nearby, a magistrate found, and the prisoners marched away to the town jail. A small escort was formed to take the body of Lieutenant Daniels to the mortuary, and lodgings were found in a hotel for Fonthill, Jenkins, and Mzingeli. The latter not without argument, as usual, because of his colour. The next morning, Simon reported to the senior British officer in the town, who happened to be a naval lieutenant commander named Evans. The man was puzzled by Fonthill's arrival, for the strictest security had been imposed on his journey, and Simon warned the commander of the importance of keeping the news of the impending attack under the tightest of wraps. "Which way do you intend to go in?" asked Evans, sucking on his pipe. "I thought it would be safer to go up around the north of the lake and slip south across the border on the other side. I know the frontier's not strictly patrolled, and felt that it would probably be the best way for the raiding force to go in, too."
"Good God, no!" exclaimed Evans. "There's no way you, certainly not several thousand men, can tramp right round the lake and enter GEA without the Germans knowing. The alarm would be raised as soon as you sniffed at the frontier. No, no, go straight across the lake. We can take you over."
"What, and the invading force, too?" Evans extracted his pipe and used the stem to point at a large map of Lake Victoria pinned to his wall.
"Yes, straight across as the dear old crow flies, old chap."
Fonthill frowned. "But I understood that the Germans have ships on the lake and regularly patrol it."
"Used to, old boy."
There was a definite note of pride in Evans's voice.
"We've just sunk their 80-ton steamer Muensa, and even if they did manage to refloat her, her 2 7-pounder guns would be no match now for the little fleet we've managed to put together. We've now got 6 steamers, including 2 of 1,000 tons each, plus 3 tugs."
He leant back and puffed his pipe proprietorially.
"As I'm sure you know, Lake Victoria is the largest lake in Africa, with a surface area of about 27,000 square miles. But now we control it completely. We could take Sir John French's BEF across to the German side without the slightest hindrance. And what's more," he leant forward, "I reckon we can take your little army across during the night without the enemy having the faintest idea of what's going on."
Fonthill nodded slowly. "That certainly does change things. She could take me and my 2 men across to the other side of the lake, say, tomorrow night, during darkness."
"Certainly. Where do you want to be landed?"
"As near as possible to Bukoba, so that we can reconnoitre the town and be picked up again the following night."
"Fine."
Evans allowed the pipe to leave his mouth long enough to grin.
"Know the place reasonably well, as it happens. Used to go across and have a drink once or twice with my German opposite number."
He used his pipe stem again as a marker.
"Just north of the town, about here. There's quite a wide beach, shallow enough for us to land you and the chaps to follow. But far enough, I would think, from the town and its defences to escape detection. We'll drop you ashore, you can see for yourself. Would you be happy with that?"
Fonthill leant across and extended his hand. "Very happy, thank you."
"Good. But you have probably underestimated the length of the voyage. It's about 180 miles from here to Bukoba, so we shall need to set out tomorrow morning to make the crossing and allow you to land under cover of darkness. So we'd need to set sail at about 10 a.m, agreed?"
"Agreed." Evans insisted on coming with them, and the following morning they assembled on the jetty at Kisumu and then boarded a steam pinnace. A course was set to the southwest, and 5 men, Fonthill, Jenkins, Mzingeli, Evans, and the young sub-lieutenant commanding the pinnace, clustered together in the vessel's little cabin to drink rum and study an old map Evans had managed to acquire of Bukoba and its environs.
"I doubt if this will be of much use to you," said the sailor. "It's quite a bit marshy, as I remember the place. So you'll have to be careful in planning the attack. Now, let's have another spot of rum, and I suggest you close your eyes for as long as you can. I'll wake you when we're near to the opposite shore. We won't run you in. But we will put you in a dinghy and row you onto the beach. Much quieter."
The moon was high and disconcertingly shedding a bright light across the water when the pinnace hove to. The shoreline a distant but distinctly darker smudge to the west, and the dinghy was lowered into the water. The 3 men shook hands with Evans Then they clustered together in the little craft as a brawny seaman dug in the oars, and they headed for German territory. The sky was just beginning to redden in the east as the prow of the dinghy crunched onto the shingle shore. Bonthill looked around anxiously, but there were no dwellings on the shoreline, only low shrubbery lining the edge of the beach. They slipped calf-length into the water and waded to the shingle before running to the protection of the greenery, as the seamen backed the oars and the dinghy slipped away into the vastness of the lake.
"Where to now, Baxter?" asked Jenkins.
"Well, according to Evans and this old map, the town's about a couple of miles down there," he nodded. "To the left. It straddles the Canoni River, and it's on a small, marshy plain surrounded by hills and a few limestone koppies. But," he squinted around, "the first thing to do is to make sure that this beach is big enough to land about 1,500 troops. You two go that way," he pointed to the right, "and I'll take a look the other way, back here in 10 minutes. The little party broke up and reassembled well within the 10 minutes. The three squatted under a low mimosa tree. Jenkins smoothed his moustache.
"Looks good enough where we've been," he said. "There's an house we could see through the trees right at the far end. Perhaps some kind of custom place by the look of it. But nobody seemed to be there. The good thing was that all the beach is shingle. Firmer, look you, than sand. So we could bring guns ashore."
Fonthill nodded. "I quite agree, but the beach is a bit on the small side. It'll be some time before everyone gets ashore, so surprise'll be everything. Let's take a walk and see what's between here and the town. Remember, if we see anyone, just nod, don't talk. And," he recovered a revolver from under his shirt, "we mustn't use these unless we're in obvious danger.
Right, let's go."
Through the fringe of trees and scrub that lined the beach, they found a dirt track road lying parallel to the shoreline. The sun was beginning to rise, but no one was about. They pushed on up and over a ridge and made their way through what Mzingeli confirmed was a matoke plantation before being confronted by a larger hill. Simon made a note. This could be a good defensive position for the Germans and would have to be taken quickly by the invaders. The nearer they came to the town, the more marshy the ground became, and it was necessary sometimes to wade through water chest deep. Fonthill noted that Bukobe itself did seem to be surrounded by a series of ridges that looked down into the town, all of which would have to be taken by the attacking force. The trio continued their walk, carrying now a rake, a fork, and a spade that they'd taken from a farm backing onto the marsh. Splashed by mud, they now looked in the early light like farm workers, but they met only a few black labourers who gave them a surly wave. The town itself did not seem to be large, and in this early morning was largely unpopulated. When Simon had noted the exact position of the wireless mast and transmitting station, he decided that they'd seen enough and that it would be unwise to linger longer and risk their discovery, and so reveal the purpose of their mission. Accordingly, they sauntered back to the beach and crept under the shade of bushes to avoid the heat of the afternoon sun. Taking it in turns to stand guard, they found it not unpleasant, dozing, eating their sandwiches, and drinking a little rum and water from their flasks, which they'd left hidden before setting off on their reconnaissance. A few hours later, a pinprick of light flashed on and off out on the lake, and Simon responded with his own torch. Within minutes, the low profile of the dinghy emerged from the darkness, and they scrambled aboard, insisting this time at relieving the seamen and taking it in turns to row. The pinnace, which, with an anxious Evans aboard, had stood out in the middle of the lake while they were ashore, was waiting for them, and they immediately steamed back towards Kusumu. Simon disclosed little of what they'd seen to Evans, who seemed to respect his reticence, and they slept for most of the return crossing. Fonthill was glad to find the Mombasa train waiting with steam up. He was anxious to report back to General Wapshire, but equally anxious that no news of the planned raid should leak from any quarter before he did so. The fewer people who knew about it in Kisumu, the better. They quickly regained their bags and rifles from their hotel and boarded the train, this time guarded by a different section of the KAR, led only by a sergeant, who saluted them and put them in the leading carriage. Although they sat their rifles at the ready throughout the dusty, hot journey, keenly looking ahead and to the sides for possible ambush, the trip was uneventful, and they regained Mombasa towards the end of the following day. Having telegraphed ahead, they were met at the station by a grinning Alice.
"News! News!" she cried as they stepped down onto the milling platform.
"Don't tell me the war is over," cried Fonthill in mock distress. "I'm banking on winning the VC in this show."
"No, no, of course not, but Wapshare's been replaced.
Good Lord, why?" "He did well enough at Tunga. It wasn't his fault the thing was a mess."
"I don't really know, but he's already gone off to command the 33rd Division in Mesopotamia. The word is that he's disappointed because he regards it as a demotion and a censuring for what happened at Tunga."
Well, a divisional command on an active front certainly shouldn't be seen as that. But who's taking his place?"
"My favourite general, Mickey Tai. He's already taken over and wants to see you immediately on your return."
Simon pulled a face. "I hope he doesn't want to cancel the attack on Bukoba. I reckon we can pull it off."
"I doubt it. He's a fighting general, if ever there was one. And I'm glad he's been promoted."
Alice smiled and ran her hand over Simon's stubble.
"Look, you've got time to come to the hotel and have a bath and shave. He can wait. He's only a major general, after all."
They all grinned and piled into a rickshaw and headed for the hotel. Bathed and shaved within the hour, Fonthill reported to the CNC's headquarters. And although he was in mufti, of course, received a smart salute from the huge Sikh at the guard post. Without delay, he was ushered in to meet the Major General. The two men shook hands, Tai's blue eyes twinkling as he did so.
"I've already met your wife, Fonthill," he said. "Remarkable woman, as I'd always heard. I do congratulate you, my dear fellow. My God, she's as feisty under fire as any unsubaltern I've ever met."
Simon nodded and pulled a face.
"Well, thank you, General. You're quite right. She worries the life out of me, even though I've grown used to her, crouching there with pencil and notebook at the firing line in so many campaigns now. But tell me..."
He paused and frowned. "I do hope you're not going to pull out of the Bukoba show, are you?"
Tai puffed out his cheeks. "Good God, no. Well, I hope not. All depends on what you tell me. You know, we never met in India, I believe. Not even on the frontier during the Pathan uprising. But I know all about you, so I'm anxious to have your report now. Fire away." "Is it possible?"
"Certainly. Evans, he's the commander of the Lake Fleet in Kisumu, at the railhead at the lake."
"Yes, I know."
"He certainly believes he can take, what is it, about 1,500 men across the lake?"
"About that, yes."
Tai yelled a command and the door was flung open by a beaming black orderly.
"Tea, you grinning monkey!" the general cried. "For two!"
He turned back to Fonthill. "Milk or lemon?"
Lemon in this climate, thanks." "Quite right. With lemon then, you rascal. So move your arse and be quick about it."
But he grinned as he shouted and the grin was returned.
"Now, where were we? Ah, yes, about 1,500 men. Can we get across without detection? Presumably under darkness, attack the town, put the radio station out of action, knock the place about a bit with that number, do you think, Fonthill?"
"I doubt if I can spare more."
"Yes, I believe so." Simon thought for a moment. "I don't know how many men the Germans have to defend the town. Certainly I saw absolutely no sign of any military apart from one or two black askaris guarding the radio station. Evans believes that the standing garrison's only about 300, but he also feels that there are about five times that number within marching distance of the town."
Tai frowned.
"That means we have to get in swiftly and strike quickly before the reinforcements get up. Show me the lie of the land."
Fonthill produced the rough map he'd drawn on the train journey.
"Seems to me, General," he said, "that the secret lies in getting swiftly inland and sweeping round the outskirts of the town, taking in these ridges that surround the place and look down on it. Once there, you have the town at your mercy. There are hills here and here by the beach," he pointed, "where the Germans, if they are sensible, will rush to oppose you shortly after landing. So you'll have to take them quickly."
"What about going along the shoreline, this way, and attacking from the north?
It's very marshy there, sometimes waist deep. But if you have the men, it would be worth sending a battalion that way to create a diversion, at least. There's a plantation here which could provide defensive positions for the Germans. If I may make a suggestion..."
The blue eyes smiled. Suggest away, old chap. I'm listening to every word. I understand that you advised General Wolseley on how to attack the Bapedi Nation on the Mozambique border. If your advice was good enough for Wolseley, then for sure it's good enough for me. Fonthill returned the smile, half embarrassed. That's kind of you, General. Obviously, you have to get in quickly, and one of the problems is that the beach, while suitable for landing in most ways, is a bit small to take such a large contingent of men. So you will need to buy time, so to speak, to get them all ashore. Quite so. So you will need a diversion to create confusion among the defenders and distract from the main landing place. The river here, he pointed, curls round, and there's a ferry there. If Evans could send a couple of ships, say, just south of the town here, it could lure the Germans into thinking that you intended a landing there, and so persuade them to divert troops to defend the ferry crossing. And also, if the naval guns could direct fire on the custom house to the north of where the main landing will be, just about here, he pointed again, it would add to the merry dance you would be leading the Huns. Good idea. Let me discuss this with my staff. This seems a pretty good plan to me. There was a brief pause while the tea was brought in. Simon raised his cup and then asked, May I ask, what troops do you have for all this? You'll need some good men to get in, strike quickly and get out again.
Indeed.
The 25th Royal Fusiliers, what do you call them? The Frontiersmen. Those are the boys. They've only just landed, but their CO is bursting to get into action. Says they need absolutely no acclimatization, so I shall send them straight in. Strange bunch. Lots of elderly fellers amongst them, but they look a hardy lot. Weren't you involved with them?
Fonthill smiled wanly.
Not really. I was offered the command, but I felt that Driscoll, whom I knew vaguely in South Africa, didn't deserve to lose his regiment in my favour, so I refused it. I'm much happier doing what I am now.
Very well. Now finish your tea and get back to that remarkable wife of yours. You'll come in with us, presumably.
Simon drained his cup. Good Lord, yes. If you'll have me, that is.
Wouldn't dream of leaving you behind.
And, of course, bring in old 657 or whatever he's called, and your black tracker.
352, yes. Thank you. When do you move?
It'll take a few days to get the troops together.
Just one more thing.
Yes. Ty frowned.
The bloody War Office won't let me take command of the operation. They say that, as CNC, I must stay here and play at soldiers on my desktop. So I've given command to General Stewart.
Know him?
No, I don't think so. First-class chap. You'll meet him soon.
He held out his hand.
Give my regards to your wife, and thank you for your good work on this. Oh, and by the way, for what you did when that train was attacked.
Ty tightened his grip and shook Simon's hand warmly.
God knows why the army let you go, Fonthill.
You would have been on the general staff, covered in gold braid if you'd stayed on after the Second Afghan War, and I would have been calling you sir by now.
Back in the hotel, Alice, Jenkins and Mzingeli joined Fonthill in a corner of the bar where they could not be overheard, to take whiskies and soda, a lemonade in the case of Mzingeli. After hearing Simon's story, Alice leant forward eagerly.
Good, she said. When do we start?
Jenkins looked at the ceiling wearily as Simon slowly replaced his glass.
We,
he said.
We. There is no we about this, my love. You are not going on this expedition, Alice, and that is the beginning and end of it. This is an army operation that will involve a great deal of danger, and there cannot possibly be a place for a woman in it.
Jenkins stood up. I have a feeling that I've heard this argument before, he said. If you will excuse us, I will take old Jelly and buy him a glass of milk to sober him up, see? Come on, boyo.
They'd hardly left before Alice exploded.
Army? Army! I am in the bloody army as much as you are, Simon. At least I am formally accredited to it, which is more than you can say. Of course I am coming.
This is my job, dammit. I must report on something that sounds as though it might produce the first bit of good news since this bloody war started.
Simon sighed. Oh, well, Alice, you might find that you have a problem with Stuart. I can well imagine that he won't want a woman in his invasion force.
Well, that's just jolly hard luck for General Stuart. Kitchener intervened to get me ashore at Tunga, and if necessary, I will get King Bloody George to step in, or even the Kaiser, for that matter.
She leant forward and gripped his hand. Simon, my love, I must do my job, just as you must too. You must understand that. Simon lifted her hand to his lips. Very well, darling. We've been through this so many times before. I certainly will do nothing to stop you coming with us, of course. He gave her a wry smile. At least I might get a better cup of tea if you do come. I think 352's losing his touch. His tea these days tastes like stewed prunes. They both smiled and, leaning forward, exchanged a chaste kiss. The next morning, Alice rose well before Simon and crept quietly out into the already sultry morning and summoned a rickshaw. "To the army, GHQ," she said firmly. What was the point? She argued to herself as the black boy jogged along between the shafts before her. In having established a good relationship with the commander-in-chief of the British Army in British East Africa, if she didn't fully exploit that relationship. Alice returned at mid-morning to find that Simon and his two companions had left the hotel, but those who knew her would have recognised the very self-satisfied smile on her face as she sat in the bar and ordered herself coffee, cold milk, and a small chaser of single malt whisky. It took Tai about 3 weeks to assemble his force. He knew that the success of the mission was vital after the Tanga debacle, and he plundered some of the best troops from throughout his command. They congregated on the eastern shore of Lake Victoria. The newly arrived 25th Royal Fusiliers, a detachment from the loyal North Lancs, the 3rd Battalion of the King's African Rifles, with two guns of the 28th Mountain Battery, a full machine gun section from the East African Regiment, and the 4 machine guns of the Volunteer Maxim Company, roughly 1,500 men, as originally planned. The day before the main force set out, Stuart ordered 2 ships to cross the lake and make a feint away from Bukoba towards the Kagera River. Simon was glad to see that his advice was being taken by the general, whom he had only met briefly before disembarkation. On the voyage across the lake in the leading ship, Fonthill sought out Lieutenant Colonel Driscoll, the CO of the 25th Fusiliers, the frontiersman, as much out of curiosity to see what kind of men he had narrowly escaped from commanding, as from desire to meet Driscoll himself. He found the colonel, sprawled with his men on the deck of the steamer, ready to be the first ashore. Driscoll was a large, good-looking man with a bristling moustache and a very loud voice. In fact, as Fonthill introduced himself, the colonel struggled to his feet and boomed, "Delighted, Fonthill! Absolutely delighted!" So loudly that Simon worried that the German defences would hear and be alerted. Fonthill squatted down beside him, and immediately the two began reminiscing about the Boer War. Driscoll and he had shared similar experiences during that conflict, with each acting as scouts, and in the end commanding a column. But they'd never met. Simon steered the conversation towards the 400 men who constituted Driscoll's command.
"I gather you've got a rather strange bunch under you," he said.
Driscoll frowned for a moment, and Fonthill feared that he'd given offence.
"Well," responded the colonel, "I suppose you could call them strange."
He grinned.
"To start with, as you can see," he gestured towards his men, "our average age must be well above that of any other battalion in the British Army, but they're all fit as fiddles. We include Outram and Silas, the big game hunters. Splendid shots, of course. I believe that Silas, who's 63, must be the oldest serving man in the whole damned army. We've got cowboys from Canada and the States, prize fighters, acrobats, including one fellow who can climb stairs on his head or something like that. There's a couple of MPs, some music hall comedians, and even some university professors. Damn it, Fonthill, they know the Empire. They know how to rough it, and they're as keen as mustard to have a go at the Kaiser and his Prussians. Proud to command them, I can tell you.
Bonthill nodded and returned the grins that were being directed at him from the faces looking toward him and the colonel. For a moment he regretted giving up the chance of leading these men into action. It would have been an unusual challenge. Then Driscoll was speaking again.
I hear that you've already been on the other side of this pond and sorted out the plan of attack,
he said, one eyebrow raised. Well, Simon shifted awkwardly.
I gave Ty a few suggestions, that's all. He's got a good record, as I'm sure you know.
You don't give a fighting major general his plan of attack.
You're going in first? More or less.
The colonel's teeth shone in the moonlight.
We're going on to the beach first, I gather, which is quite an honour. But my orders are not to go inland, but to advance to the town, more or less along the shoreline. Then we're to capture the first ridge we meet. You must know it. Consolidate there and cover the main force as they land. You have specific orders yourself? Do you have to stay alongside Stuart?
No. He probably didn't want me hanging about him. He'll have his own ideas of how to attack the town.
Well, that's splendid. Why don't you come along with us? Show us the way, so to speak.
Bonthill bit his lip. He looked along the serried row of faces of the frontiersmen turned towards them both. There was a lot of silver hair to be seen under their caps and quite a few gnarled moustaches. It would be good to see how they reacted to being in the van of the attack. But advancing along the shoreline, that would mean struggling through that blasted marsh again, and then, in all probability, attacking through the plantation with its many trees offering cover for the defenders. But of course he could not refuse the invitation. Delighted, he said. Before dawn, but under a full moon, the ships carrying the troops put their human cargoes ashore at the little inlet where Simon, Jenkins and Mzingeli had landed several weeks before, now identified as Kiaya Bay. The disembarkation, however, was not carried out without some initial vicissitudes. The Germans had posted a lookout station on nearby Busira Island. Had they been alerted? And the flotilla was seen approaching in the full moonlight. The alarm was given, but two of the ships executed a feint towards the customs house, identified originally by Jenkins and Mzingeli, and drew the fire of a German field gun sighted there. The landings themselves were carried out far enough away from the town to prevent defenders being rushed to the little bay to prevent the invaders going ashore. It was, in effect, a complete reversal of the Tonga disaster. Alice and the small group of correspondents allowed to accompany the mission watched the first landings from the deck of a steamer, waiting its turn to disembark its troops. She quickly focused her field glasses onto the little figures. She knew they were the Fusiliers, who were the first ashore, and drew in her breath as she made out the unmistakable outlines of Simon, Jenkins, and Mzingeli in the first wave. Splashing through the water, holding their rifles aloft.
Ah, your man is there, then.
She turned quickly and found the unwelcome figure of Herman de Villiers standing at her side, also focusing his glasses on the shore.
What? Oh, I don't know where he is, as a matter of fact.
Alice felt an instinctive desire to tell the Boer nothing, and certainly no fragment of information that would implicate Simon in any way.
Yach. De Villiers lowered his glasses and tugged at his black beard. I understood that he was going ashore with the first battalion to land, the Fusiliers.
Really?
Alice summoned up a smile.
Ah, you are so well informed, Mr. De Villiers. Better than I, in fact.
Oh, I don't think so, Mrs. Fonthill. No, I don't think so. But we will see.
He adjusted his spectacles, nodded to her and shuffled away, picking his way along the crowded deck. Frowning, Alice picked up her binoculars again and tried to pick out Simon and his two companions among the khaki figures tumbling ashore and making their way up the beach. He'd gone. Where? She wondered. Where?
Was he being expected to lead the troops in the van?
She lowered the glasses.
Thank God the first wave of troops had gone ashore without meeting any opposition. How long would that last?
Simon, Jenkins, and Mzingeli had, in fact, landed right in the van of the raiding force, even before General Stuart had gone ashore. Driscoll was the first to tread ashore, and he looked inquiringly over his shoulder. Fonthill pointed ahead into the thin line of trees, and then indicated a left turn. The colonel nodded and broke into a leaden-footed trot, disappearing into the trees.
"Oh, bloody hell!" shouted Simon. "Why didn't he wait?"
He turned to the others. "We'd better catch him up before he leads everybody into an ambush."
"I'm not too sure about the catching up bit," puffed Jenkins. "Me right boot's full of water, and I'm sloshing about, and I'm not the fastest mover at the best of times these days, look you. Send old Jelly to slow the bugger down."
Fonthill nodded to Mzingeli, and the black man strode effortlessly ahead in the wake of the colonel.
"Tell him," Simon called after him, "that there's a ridge immediately ahead on the left, which could be the Germans' first defensive position. He must be careful."
The tracker raised a hand in acknowledgement and was gone. They found him a couple of minutes later, crouched by the side of Driscoll and his senior officers, examining the black outline of the ridge that stretched above them. Simon nodded towards it. "Any sign of occupation?" he asked.
"Don't know, but my instincts are to march straight in and take it now."
"It's your show, Driscoll. But may I suggest we send in Mzingeli here to go up it first and find out? He moves like a panther and can scout it and be back within 10 minutes. Not too long to wait, I would suggest, eh?" The tracker's teeth flashed in the early dawn.
"I go if you want."
Driscoll nodded.
"Good idea. All my chaps aren't here from the beach yet anyway. Make it quick, boy, make it quick."
Fonthill noticed a slight frown across the usually impassive face of Mzingeli at being called boy, but then he nodded and disappeared into the gathering light. The Fusiliers had hardly gathered behind their colonel before the tracker was back. He avoided Driscoll and reported to Fonthill.
"Nobody up there, Nkos," he said, "but troops could be coming from direction of town, I think. I did not stay to find out."
"Good. Quite right."
Driscoll turned his head and spoke to his second in command.
"Advance to the front in open order. No one to fire unless I give the order. On the top, if there's no position, take up defensive positions facing the south all along the ridge. Spread the word to the officers."
"Very good, sir."
Orders were barked, and the frontiersmen quickly and quietly began to spread out on either side of their colonel, moving away under cover of the morning mist that was beginning to rise. Fonthill was impressed at the discipline of the troops, not the adventurous, individualistic rabble that he had half expected. They could have been guardsmen the way they dispersed in an orderly fashion following their officers. He nodded to Jenkins and Mzingeli, and the three picked up their rifles and followed the large figure of Driscoll, who had already begun the climb up the ridge, the edge of which was now becoming more sharply defined in the early morning light. Simon sniffed the air. Jenkins nodded.
"Yes, it's going to bloody rain," grunted the Welshman.
"Just as me bleeding wet sock was beginning to dry out. We're going to get soaked, look you."
"Good thing, though. If the Germans are coming from the town to face us, they could literally get bogged down in that damned marsh.
Come on, keep up.
We must get to the top of the ridge before the Hun does." They did so, for it was an easy climb. The ridge stretched from just above the shoreline inland towards the north, and Fonthill realized that it was a perfect position from which to cover the troops still landing on the beach behind them. Ahead of them, however, stretched an even higher ridge with the Matoke plantation and swampland to cross before it would have to be scaled. He looked behind him. Troops were pouring ashore from lighters and forming up on the beach. He called up to Driscoll.
"Looks as though most of the men have been landed on the beach, Colonel." "Good. Can't see any sign of us being attacked yet. I'll give it another 10 minutes and then advance on that next ridge."
"Very well. It's difficult ground between the two. Marshland and a plantation."
"So I understand. But we'd better get on with it before the Hun comes up. They will surely know we've landed by now."
A runner came up and reported to the Colonel, who turned his head and shouted back to Fonthill.
"Everyone's ashore quite safely, thank God. Now I'm ordered to push on. Do stay with me."
"Of course," The whole battalion now moved slowly down the hillside and immediately descended into swampland. As they did so, desultory fire began to open up on them from the hill ahead. It was thin and poorly directed, and Simon guessed that the main defending force had not yet been able to reach the hill in sufficient numbers to pose a definitive threat to the Fusiliers. Nevertheless, it was unpleasant to have to wade through the swamp, thigh and sometimes chest high, holding rifles at shoulder level to keep them dry, while the odd bullet hissed into the mud around them. Driscoll shouted an order, and several weather-beaten frontiersmen stopped wading, carefully sighted their rifles, and began to reply to the snipers up on the hill. Predictably, it now began to rain, and at this point Jenkins missed his footing and slipped neck-high into the murky brown water before he could regain his balance.
"Oh, shit!" he called. "Now I'm bloody well soaked all over, look you. I have to tell you, Baxter, that I'm getting really fed up with this post, and so I am."
His misery suddenly turned to fear as a thought struck him.
"Hey!" he shouted. "They don't have crocodiles in this wet muck, do they?"
Simon recalled that his old comrade, although a fighter as courageous as a lion and as skilled in battle as a gladiator, held three terrors: fear of heights, water, he had never learned to swim, and, most of all, of crocodiles and alligators.
"Only little ones," shouted Fonthill. "Zingeli, see what you can do to help the big baby."
A grinning Mzingeli turned and waded back to the Welshman, offering the end of his rifle to pull him clear.
"Look," he said, "follow me. I find better ground, I think. Step where I step, both of you."
"Thanks, Mzingeli," called Fonthill, marvelling yet again at the tribesman's instinctive ability to become familiar with new country, though far from home, and to sense its perils and discomforts and avoid them.
"Lead on, we'll follow."
Soon they came to firmer ground, and stamping their feet to remove the mud, they began to enter the Matoke plantation, which on their reconnaissance Fonthill had noted as a possibly strong defensive position for the Germans. The banana-like plant grew from trees, thick as palms, which could provide cover for good marksmen, which the German askaris were noted to be. Simon looked to either side and realized that the Fusiliers had inevitably bunched together as they had waded through the swamp, and they continued to do so as they picked their way between the trees. Fonthill opened his mouth to issue orders to spread out, but bit his lip and refrained from doing so. He was not in command here. Suddenly there was a burst of firing from up ahead, and Fonthill caught a glimpse of conical caps, as worn by the German askari, appearing around the side of trees, some 300 yards into the plantation. Puffs of smoke came from their long rifles. At the same time, two Fusiliers to his right staggered and fell. He heard Driscoll's stentorian voice shout, "Stretcher bearers!" And then, "Advance at the double, fire as you go from tree to tree, push the bastards back!" The plantation had now become a chaotic battlefield, with the rain settling on the mud underfoot, causing it to cling and suck at everyone's boots as they slipped and slid from tree to tree. It was difficult now to define the enemy up ahead, but it was clear that the German askaris were living up to their reputation for bravery and musketry, for bullets thudded into the trees behind which Fonthill and his three comrades were trying to find flimsy shelter. The crackle of rifle fire now seemed to merge with the thunder of the tropical rain as it bounced from the palm leaves high above. Shouted orders, both in German and English, could be heard from up ahead, but it was hard to distinguish between friend and foe in the semi-darkness of the plantation.
"Can't see the buggers,"
muttered Jenkins as he wiped the rain from his forehead. He had, of course, lost his pith helmet somewhere in the swamp, but he pushed his rifle around the side of the tree, took careful aim, and fired. A cry from the depths of the plantation showed that his bullet had struck home. Fonthill had now lost sight of the colonel, but with lowered head he ran as best he could from tree to tree, occasionally stopping to fire ahead when he caught a glimpse of a black face peering from the foliage. Jenkins and Mzingeli remained at his side, firing whenever they had the opportunity.
"Keep going," gasped Simon.
We can't afford to stop. We must push them out of this plantation, because it's their best cover for miles. Once we get them out into the open, we shall have a better chance, because by the look of it, we're outnumbering them.
Blimey, muttered Jenkins. Can't see much evidence of that.
Eventually, however, they found the density of the plantation was thinning, and at last they plunged from its edge into more open country, the beginning of the climb up to the next ridge. Nevertheless, the vista ahead was hardly clearer than it had been among the matoke trees, for the hillside ahead of them was covered in scrub and long grass, from which the flashes of rifle fire could be seen, as the askaris disputed every inch of territory. The sky above them had turned a dull yellow, but it still bulged with rain clouds, and the atmosphere seemed even more humid in the open than it did in the plantation. What was clear was that the Germans' famed colonial troops were fighting a splendid rearguard action, stoically firing from their limited cover, reloading, retreating a few yards, and then firing again. Suddenly, the boom of a distant heavy artillery piece cut through the cacophony of the rifle fire. It sounded far away, but a great flash of flame erupted from the ground ahead of Simon and his three comrades, sending sand, grit, and scrubs rising in a great V-shape. Damn! Hissed Fonthill. I didn't know the Germans had heavy artillery. Where the hell could it have come from? Jenkins puffed out his cheeks.
I don't know, and I don't much care, see? As long as the bloody thing fires at somebody else.
Only two more shells exploded on the hillside, however, because a distant booming from the lake showed that the British warships were now engaging in an artillery battle with the solitary German big gun. It quickly fell silent, either because of a direct hit or, more likely, because the enemy had moved the gun out of range. Its removal, however, did nothing to accelerate the dogged retreat of the askaris and their white officers, a glimpse of whose pith helmets and cloth neck protectors could occasionally be caught through the brush. The enemy's fire remained accurate and consistent, and the climb to the top of the hill continued to be contested by them inch by inch, bush by bush. Eventually, Driscoll and his men reached the top of the ridge, and Fonthill crawled forward and slumped by his side.
"Have you lost many men, Colonel?"
he asked. The big man took a draught from his water bottle, wiped the dribble from his chin in a great swipe, and wedged the cork back into the canteen with a savage thump. It seemed that everything he did was larger than life.
"Surprisingly few, old chap,"
he grinned.
"Rather amazing, really, because they've kept up a pretty fierce firing. I thought they had us on toast coming through that blasted plantation, but we've cleared this damned ridge. Trouble is," he nodded ahead, "there's another one to get up and down before we get anywhere near the town itself. And at the bottom of this hill, there's more bloody bogland. Lordy, what a country. It looks as though the Germans are going to contest every bit of the way."
Simon nodded to his right. "Any news about our advance further inland?"
"Not yet, but the askaris haven't tried to outflank us from that direction, so I hope that means our line is holding."
He turned and shouted to his adjutant,
"George, get the men moving again! Can't hang about!"
All through that wet and humid day, the fusiliers advanced doggedly, wading through more swamp despite strong resistance, and eventually taking the third ridge, soon to be known as Fusiliers Knoll. Fonthill and his two companions fought with them, acting as riflemen in the front of the line, and occasionally, whenever Driscoll queried the terrain ahead, giving directions as to the best route to follow. By late afternoon, contact was established with Stuart's force to the north, where the loyal North Lancs and the 29th Punjabis had climbed and occupied Arab Ridge. Now the whole line advanced so that by dusk the British had taken all the heights commanding the town. As Fonthill, Jenkins and Mzingeli bivouacked under a bush in a desperate attempt to keep dry, Simon's thoughts turned for the first time in that fraught and busy day to Alice. He knew that she would be with the journalistic contingent close to General Stuart, the commanding officer. A comforting thought, for he doubted if Stuart could allow himself to advance too far into danger without compromising his grasp of the strategic situation. Yet would his wife stay so confined?
In a battle, she hated to be anywhere called safe. In fact, he was completely right to be concerned, for Alice had been prevented from leaving the little group of correspondents who were gathered around the general and his staff. Twice she had attempted to slip away to move towards the gunfire ahead, and twice she had been brought back by the young subaltern who was shepherding the newspaperman. "Please, madam," he scolded her the second time. "I'm already feeling extremely frustrated myself at not being allowed to go towards the firing, so don't make it worse for me by having to keep both eyes on you throughout the day. The general will kill me if you make a nuisance of yourself in the front line." Alice forced herself to grin pleasantly. "Young man," she said, "I haven't been placed on Earth to make your job easy, nor for that matter to make myself a nuisance when an action is being fought. No." She found herself fluttering her eyelashes and despised herself for doing so. "I'm here to do a job and to report on the action being fought here so that the great British public can understand what is going on, and, dear boy, I can't do that if you prevent me from seeing what the bloody hell is actually going on. Now be a splendid fellow and just turn your back for a second and let me get to the front. I shall not be a nuisance, I promise. I just want to make a note or two from nearer the action." The subaltern sighed. "It's more than my commission is worth, madam. Please return to where the others are sitting. We'll brief you all as the day goes on." "Oh, well, bugger it. On your head be it if the readers of the Morning Post are misinformed. Very well, I promise not to stray. But can you tell me one thing?" A frown puckered the young man's forehead. "Probably not, madam. But ask me anyway." "Very well, now tell me, and I promise I won't quote you, so you can speak off the record. Why do you think that German field gun fired at our ships before we landed? Is there a possibility that they were warned we were coming?"
"Oh, I really don't know that. You must ask the general."
"Very well, I shall. But I don't want to do it with all my competitors listening."
She laid a hand on his arm.
"Do you think you could be an angel and perhaps get your colleagues' views on this point? Just their opinions, you understand. I cannot understand why the gun was mounted there if no one was expecting some sort of invasion."
"Well, I'll try, Mrs. Griffith, but I can't make any promises. Now do come back to the journalist's enclosure, there's a good lady."
"Very well, but try really hard, Lieutenant, won't you?"
He did indeed try, for later in the day he sought out Alice.
"The general view amongst the staff, Miss Griffith," he confided, "is that someone must have alerted the Germans."
The lieutenant looked uncomfortable even as he spoke.
"Now please, don't take that as gospel, because it's only gossip, really, madam. The gun, it seemed, was very recently moved to its position, and the word is that a spy in the British camp somehow gave a last-minute warning that we were crossing the lake in force, and as a result, the gun was ready and loaded."
Alice nodded, slowly. She had refrained from making a note in case it daunted the officer.
"How very interesting," she murmured. "But if that were true, surely the Germans would have had troops ready and waiting by the beach to dispute the landing, don't you think?"
The young man shook his head.
"We've captured a German officer, and he tells us that the general's feint by two of our warships towards the river crossing worked, and that the Germans sent a large part of their defensive force to the south to protect the crossing. Realizing their mistake, they've rushed their troops back, and this explains why their resistance has been so strong later in the day."
He looked uneasily over his shoulder.
"Now, please, Miss Griffith, do not quote me on this, or I will get into trouble. May I have your word on that?"
Alice smiled.
"You certainly do, Lieutenant. You certainly do. I shall treat all you have told me with the utmost discretion, and I am most grateful."
She planted a quick kiss on the young man's cheek, turned and walked away, frowning. A spy. In the British camp. Who on earth could that be? Troops on both sides endured a miserable night in the rain, and it was a relief for the British to be able to move forward down the slopes the next day. Still in pouring rain, to advance on Bukoba. If they thought that their commanding position on the heights would deter the enemy, they were wrong. For the German askaris and their officers fought with the same obduracy they'd shown since the return of their troops from their false errand to the south.
Inevitably, however, the defenders were forced back to the outskirts of the town, and then abruptly they melted away over the hills to the west, leaving Bukoba at the mercy of the British. The troops surged into the seemingly deserted town, and it was an Australian frontiersman from the Fusiliers, Lieutenant Dartnell, who was given the honour of lowering the German flag in the centre of the town. In what remained of the daylight that evening, Bukoba's radio mast was dismantled and destroyed by British sappers, and a German field gun was removed only to fall into the lake from the lighter, taking it to the waiting British fleet. Alice was reunited with her husband, and she immediately sat down and interrogated him, begging him for details about the Fusiliers' advance and the heavy fighting they'd encountered in the swamps and plantation on their way to capture the ridges. The four were sitting companionably on a rise above town, by a spluttering campfire after the rain had ceased with the rising of the moon, emptying Simon's whiskey bottle, milk, of course, from Zingeli, when there were explosions from the centre of Bukoba and the sky was lit by a succession of bonfires. "What the hell's going on?" demanded Fonthill, rising to his feet.
"Looks to me as though our League of Whatchacallem is having a bit of fun down there," grunted Jenkins. "It was already starting to do a bit of looting when I'd left the town to come up here."
Alice climbed up onto a knoll, the better to see. "Yes," she gasped. "Those bloody Fusiliers, the ones you nearly commanded, Simon, are sacking the town. I'm going down to see what's happening." "No, Alice," shouted Fonthill. "Don't do that."
But she had already gone.
The three hurried after her and caught her up as she stood, notebook in hand, scribbling away. She noted a Fusilier officer, glass of champagne in hand, laughing as he watched a trooper emerge from the German governor's house with a lady's toilet set in ivory. Another carried the governor's ceremonial helmet. Everywhere, houses were being looted and then torched until the very sky seemed to be alight.
"Where the hell's Driscoll?"
demanded Fonthill. "This is disgusting."
"Colonel is over there," said Mzingeli, pointing. A faint smile played on his lips. He'd not forgotten being called boy.
"Simon!" shouted Alice above the crack of the burning timbers. "For God's sake, go and tell him to restrain his men. This is not how British troops should behave."
"I quite agree."
Fonthill strode to where Driscoll and his second-in-command were standing watching the looting, seemingly quite unconcerned.
"Colonel," shouted Simon as he approached, "can't you stop this? Putting a defeated town to the torch is something that went out in Wellington's time. Your chaps shouldn't behave like this."
Driscoll waved a dismissive hand.
"Oh, don't be stuffy, Fonthill. We're not exactly the household cavalry, you know. This is all part and parcel of colonial warfare. My men are nearly all colonials. They've fought like hell today, and I'm certainly not going to stop them having a bit of fun. Nobody's getting injured. The town's virtually deserted. Relax, man."
Simon suddenly realized that Alice was at his side, notebook in hand.
"Thank you, Colonel," she said. "I intend to quote you."
And she turned on her heel and strode away, her head in the air. Driscoll sniffed.
"Your famous wife, I suppose, Fonthill. Well, let her quote away. People back home should know what happens in times of war. Look what the Germans have done in invading Belgium."
Fonthill opened his mouth to respond, but thought better of it and turned and followed Alice. Immediately he felt ashamed. Why hadn't he stayed and argued with Driscoll? Why did he always walk away from arguments these days? Why was it always Alice who showed the moral courage in confrontations like this? Perhaps it was just the advancing years.
"He must be more..."
More what? He didn't know. Anyway, it was a bit late to change his personality. He trudged on. The Fusiliers, who were almost completely responsible for the looting and fire-raising, were quickly dubbed the Boozaliers by the rest of the British troops. But no news of their after-battle behaviour reached the newsstands back home. The army's censorship saw to that, much to Alice's disgust. Once the British had completed their demolition work, the invaders counted the cost of the expedition. Only 10 of Stuart's command had been killed,
and some 20 wounded from the total of 1,500. According to prisoners, the completely outnumbered defenders, on the other hand, had sustained casualties amounting to more than 50 from their force of 350. On hearing these facts, Fonthill shook his head. "These German colonials can fight," he muttered. "They're brave, well-led and well-disciplined. If they can do as well as that, given how greatly they were outnumbered, then it doesn't augur well for this campaign. We're facing a long, hard slog, from what I can see." Jenkins wrinkled his nose.
"Better have a drink, then, while we can. Can you pass what's left of your bottle? Thank you, Bach, sir."
Chapter 5. The news of the triumph of the Bukoba raid was greeted with jubilation from a British public starved of success on the Western Front in Europe, and from the hard-pressed staff in the War Office in Whitehall. Kitchener immediately cabled his congratulations to Tye and Stuart, and it seemed as though the sacking of the town had been forgotten. But not quite, for Driscoll's fusiliers were immediately sent on border duty in British East Africa, interpreted by most observers in the colony as retribution for their misdeeds. On his return to Mombasa, Fonthill received a note of thanks and congratulations from both Tye and Stuart. Alice had indeed raised with Stuart the possibility of a spy in the British camp, having alerted the enemy, but the general had refuted any such suggestion, and Alice had been forced to leave out any reference to possible sabotage in her report on the action. Nevertheless, she made a mental note to pursue the matter when circumstances allowed. The Germans continued their attacks on the Uganda Railway, and they made a second excursion across the border of Rhodesia with an attack on a British outpost at Saisi. It was beaten off, although only after the stiffest of engagements. A second fillip to British morale in the colony, however, was received when news came from Cape Town that enemy forces in German Southwest Africa had surrendered to South African troops under the command of General Botha.
"Nice to have that bloke on our side, eh?" commented Jenkins. "I wouldn't want to be fighting him again after the runaround he gave us 15 years ago."
Fonthill nodded. "Splendid soldier and good politician. He's been having trouble as Prime Minister of South Africa with some of his Boer right-wingers who still hate the British, but he's handled them well. We could do with him up here." The three comrades had been given no further roles to play, and Simon had begun to wonder if, despite the lauding of his work at Abercorn and Bukoba, he was now regarded as too old to be useful elsewhere in this vast and demanding theatre of war. He was on the point of suggesting that they all return to the farm in Rhodesia, when suddenly attention was focused once again on the eastern seaboard of the colony. When the war had broken out, the Germans had only a handful of warships anywhere south of the equator, and only one, a 9-year-old light cruiser, the Königsberg, in Dar es Salaam, the capital of German East Africa. Forewarned that hostilities could break out, the captain of the vessel, Max Loof, had no intention of being trapped within the port by the warships of the British Navy, who dominated the Indian Ocean. On the eve of the declaration of war, therefore, he slipped out of the port and took to the high seas. There was no way he could return home to Germany, and he had no base from which to operate, but he determined to stay free as long as possible, and so pose a threat to the British and to their merchant navy, whose many tramp steamers ploughed the waters off the German colony's coast. Almost immediately he had his first success, when he captured the British merchantman the City of Winchester, newly built, at a cost of £400,000 in the Gulf of Aden. It was the British Merchant Navy's first loss of the war, and the cry, "Sink the Königsberg!" resounded loudly from the Admiralty. The hunt for the lone German cruiser, therefore, was launched immediately. In fact, Captain Loof's early success was not repeated, and he found it increasingly difficult to stay at sea with his supplies of coal running out and British warships combing the ocean for him. No ports were open to him. Where to go? He needed a hiding place. He found one in the maze of channels that formed the Rufiji Delta on the southern coast of the German colony, at a place called Salale.
It was ideal in that the Königsberg could penetrate far enough inland for its superstructure not to be seen by British ships patrolling the coast. And, at least in theory, it could slip its moorings at a moment's notice to strike at passing merchant shipping and return to its hiding place without being detected. It was also supported by the German colonists, who sent food and other supplies to the fugitive vessel, tucked away in its jungle refuge. After a few days, coal began arriving in a succession of small craft sent from Dar es Salaam, and eventually the cruiser was revictualled, refueled, and ready to put to sea. She lay for several days moored in her deep-water lair like some giant crocodile waiting for prey to pass the delta's mouth. Then Captain Lauf heard that a British cruiser had put in at Zanzibar, less than 200 miles to the north. Was she waiting there for reinforcements before combing the shoreline for his ship? He could not help but feel vulnerable. The British had so many ships. He decided to deliver a preemptive strike before the British Navy could concentrate its forces. He sailed at night, and by dawn the harbour of Zanzibar was visible. Within it was the British cruiser Pegasus, lying at the quayside. In fact, she was undergoing repairs to her boilers and was completely vulnerable. Lauf did not know this, but his 4.1-inch guns immediately opened fire at a range of some 6 miles. Unable to manoeuvre, the Pegasus was a sitting target, and although she did her best to respond with her venerable 15-year-old guns, they were no match for the German armament, and within minutes the British ship was ablaze. Lauf continued to fire, 50 shells in all, until the stricken vessel began to sink. Lauf had won the first naval battle of the Great War, and he was jubilant. But one of his engines had broken down, and he could not afford to linger. So, after firing at several onshore targets, he retreated to the open sea, sinking a recently captured German ship on the way. Within hours, the Königsberg was snugly back in her lair in the Rufiji Delta, leaving havoc and a storm of cables from the Admiralty to Zanzibar in its wake. To the impetuous Winston Churchill, the First Lord of the Admiralty, the presence of the German warship was an irritant, a constant rebuke to the most powerful navy in the world. She had to be found. Accordingly, he dispatched the cruisers Chatham, Dartmouth, and Weymouth to East Africa. As the moments ticked by, intelligence began to mount, all pointing to the Rufiji Delta as the most likely hiding place of the Königsberg. And then a lookout on the Chatham's masthead at the Delta's mouth reported seeing 2 masts inland. The elusive German cruiser had been found. Destroying it, however, was another matter. The Chatham used a spring tide to inch her way up the Delta channels until she was virtually aground. She was near enough, however, to unleash a succession of broadsides on the enemy vessel at a range of 14,800 yards. This time it was Captain Lauf's turn to be outgunned and outranged, and he was forced to sit and accept the punishment. Somehow, however, not one English shell landed on the German cruiser. For 5 days the Chatham repeated the bombardment from long range, hampered by the shallow nature of the channel, but still the Königsberg escaped serious damage. Lauf had erected a series of sophisticated shore defences in the jungle, on the shoreline of the main channel, and although Chatham turned her guns on these, they too survived without being harmed. The change of target, however, allowed Lauf to slip away even further up channel, so that once again the exact position of the fugitive ship was no longer known to the ships blockading it. And blockade it was. For although the mouth of the Delta was 40 miles across, there were sufficient ships available to prevent any attempt by the German cruiser to slip through the cordon. It was, in effect, a stalemate, and perhaps the sensible thing for the British to do was simply to let the Königsberg stew in her jungle juice for the remainder of the war, besieged by malevolent insects, baked by a tropical sun and sweating in the river's intolerable humidity. But inactivity had never appealed to Winston Churchill, and he turned to the latest weapon in the modern wartime armoury, the aeroplane. A 90-horsepower Curtiss seaplane, armed with homemade bombs containing rock-blasting gelatine,
was shipped out, complete with intrepid pilot, to find the enemy vessel and bomb her. 90 horsepower seemed to constitute a considerable amount of engineering muscle, but in the atmosphere of the Delta it was insufficient to lift even the very light aircraft to a safe height, and it crashed near Akazi Island to the south. Aeroplane and pilot were saved and took off again 2 days later. This time, skimming the treetops, the fragile machine spotted the Königsberg. She was about 12 miles upriver, moored close to a little island and cleverly hidden by high trees. Her topgallant mast had been removed, and verdant branches had been woven around her topmast. It was not possible to make a bombing attack using primitive bombs, and it was clearly impossible for large vessels to venture upstream near enough to bombard her. The strength and clever placing of Lorf's coastal defences also made it impossible to attack the ship by sending flotillas of small vessels through the channels to get close enough to launch torpedoes at her. Alas, the third flight of the Curtiss was its last, and it came down about a mile upriver. The plane was lost, and its pilot fell into the hands of the Germans and spent the rest of the war as a POW. It seemed that the cleverly hidden cruiser was virtually impervious to attack. The renewal of the campaigns on land, plus the demands exerted on the Royal Navy by the activities and eventual destruction of Admiral von Spee's South Atlantic squadron off the Falkland Islands, diverted attention from the Königsberg for some months. But Churchill, chomping on his cigar in the Admiralty in London, was not the man to let sleeping cruisers lie. It seemed clear that an air attack offered the best means of destroying the cornered ship, or at least putting it out of action. Accordingly, the bustling, monocled Admiral Herbert King Hall was dispatched from the Cape to take personal command of the East Coast operations, and with him came No. 4 Squadron of the newly formed Royal Air Service. 20 men led by Flight Lieutenants Cull and Watkins, and 2 Sopwith 807 100-horsepower seaplanes, specially shipped from Bombay. Unfortunately, the Sopwiths proved themselves to be little better in tropical conditions than the ill-fated Curtiss. They found it impossible to get airborne in the thin tropical air, and one of the two was wrecked beyond repair almost straight away. The aviators found that carrying bombs it was only possible to take off in days of high humidity, and then carrying only 1 hour's fuel and rising to a height of no more than 1,500 feet. Based on Nyororo Island, some 100 miles south of Zanzibar, the aircraft were virtually useless. But Churchill's and King Hall's faith in attacking the Königsberg by air was undiminished, and responding to the message that only exceptionally powerful machines could overcome the tropical conditions, 3 short seaplanes were sent out from Britain on board the Cunarder Laconia. On arrival, however, they were found to be old machines in a lamentable condition, and certainly no improvement on either the Curtiss or the Sopwiths. King Hall and Churchill continued their long-range arguments on the best way to crack the German nut. The Admiral proposed sending a small boat armed with torpedoes upriver. The First Lord replied, "I do not think that the chances of a rowing boat with spar torpedo going 12 miles up a creek, past a fortified fort with numerous trenches, and trying to attack a ship with searchlights and modern guns, is likely to be rosy." Churchill suggested sending in 2 battalions of Royal Marines with 6 12-pounder guns. The Admiralty said that there were no Marines to spare. But the problem of bypassing the shore defences rankled with King Hall, and it was here that a despondent, virtually redundant Simon Fonthill and his 2 companions crept into the picture. Consulting with his army colleague, General Wapshire, the Admiral was told of the scouting role carried out at Bokuba by Fonthill, Jenkins and Mzingeli. He had heard of Fonthill and knew of his reputation for getting and operating behind enemy lines, but his ears pricked up when he was told that a black tracker who had served with Fonthill and Jenkins for some years was part of the trio. So it was that Simon received a message in Mombasa asking him to meet with the Admiral the following day. No reason was given.
"Bloody hell," muttered Jenkins. "We're not joining the Navy now, are we? You know I can't swim."
Simon waved the note. "This tells me nothing of the reason why he wants to see me, but I'm more than happy to go. I'll take any job they offer me, even if it means commanding a rowing boat. I'm fed up with moping around Mombasa while people are losing their lives upcountry, and of course in Europe." He told nothing of the appointment to Alice, who, in the absence of further military action, was busy writing colour pieces about the terrain over which the war was being fought. Better to delay the inevitable argument about whether she could accompany him until he knew more about what lay ahead. On arrival, he was ushered into the Naval C&C's office with no delay. He knew a little about the Admiral, that he had joined the Navy, Nelson fashion, as a boy of 12 in 1874, weighing, it was said, 5 stone and standing just under 4 feet 4 inches in height. As King Hall stood to receive him, hand outstretched, Simon realised that the man seemed to have grown very little. Although he had the width of chest and bushy eyebrows, plus the ever-present monocle of a man of character.
"Delighted, Fonthill," he barked. "Glad you could come in at short notice. Do take a seat. A tea?"
"No, thank you, sir."
"Oh, don't sir me, my good fellow. We're almost the same age, I would guess. How old are you, by the way?"
Simon smiled inwardly. Ah, the key question early on. This was a man who didn't beat about the bush. Best not to dissemble.
"I'm a smidgen under 60, Admiral, so older than you, I fear, but I am as fit as a fiddle, as I think I've proven in Abercorn and recently at Bokuba, and may I say I am absolutely fed up with hanging about Mombasa waiting for a job. I want to fight."
"Does you credit, Fonthill?"
The Admiral extracted his monocle from under one shaggy eyebrow, breathed on it and began to polish it. He had a remarkably formidable face, jowled and heavily lined. Simon recalled that he liked to describe himself as
the ugliest man in the British Navy.
He wondered idly if he was married, and if his wife cared about appearances.
"Not worried too much about your advancing years, Fonthill, but what I have in mind will demand that you really are fit. What do you weigh?"
"Oh, about 11.5 stone. I've lost a bit in this climate."
"Haven't we all? Good. A paunch will be rather out of place where I would like to send you."
"And where would that be, Admiral?" The little man stood.
"Come over here."
And he walked to where a large wall map of the British East Africa coastline dominated the room. He jabbed his finger onto the Rufiji Delta.
"Ever been here?"
"Ah." Simon nodded. "So it's to be the Königsberg, is it?"
"It certainly is. Been in these channels, have you? I understand you've travelled widely in Africa."
Fonthill felt his heart sink. "Not been exactly there, Admiral." He paused, and then his heart lifted a little. "But my man, Zingeli, he's a black man, of course, originally a tracker from the Malakala tribe in what is now called Rhodesia. He's been with me from my days with Rhodes through the Boer War, and would have come with us to Tibet if I'd not needed him to run my farm here in Africa. But the point is that he does know the Delta. He told me so when we were discussing the Königsberg the other day. He is to fish there, I gather. He's a first-class chap. I would trust him with my life."
"Ah, that sounds more like it. Now, let me tell you the background concerning this bloody ship and what I want you to do."
For the next 10 minutes, the little admiral, his eyes blazing, described the events of the last year concerning the German cruiser, the search for her, the failed attempts to bomb her from the air, the abortive attacks with light craft up the channels, and the fact that she had now disappeared once again into the tracery of waterways in the Delta.
"We've sunk a block ship at one of the Delta mouths," he continued, "but there are plenty of other ways she can get out. We've also laid some dummy mines in the other channels, but I don't think for a minute that these would fool anyone, not least a crafty operator like Captain Louvre."
Fonthill nodded. "So what exactly do you want of me?"
"3 main things."
He banged his hand, palm extended, onto the map.
"Firstly, find this damned ship. She's retreated further inland, we know that, but we can't pin her down. Wherever she is, she'll be protected by the shore defences in the jungle, which this man, Louvre, first-class fellow, by the sound of him, has erected. So the second task is to find out where these are, their armament and so on. Thirdly, I would like you to put forward whatever suggestions you have about destroying this bit of naval Germany in Africa. Simple, eh? Quite straightforward, Matt.
Simon grinned. Oh, absolutely. A bit of a summer cruise up 17 rivers, by the sound of it.
Quite so. Now,
the Admiral led him back to his chair.
I can't tell you how to go about this, but it seems to me that a bit of light sculling or canoeing up the channels is required. The jungle round about the channels is quite impenetrable by land, I'm told. Though,
he held up his hand.
One other thing, we'll need to have details of the depths of the various channels. Can't have our vessel stuck in shallow waters, allowing old Louvre to fire on them from the jungle.
He stood, held his head to one side, thrust his right hand into the pocket of his uniform jacket in admiral style, and looked at Fonthill quizzically.
Quite a job, actually, Fonthill. Think you can do it?
Simon paused for a moment before replying. To be honest, I don't know until we try it. You said you'd tried sending small craft up the various channels.
Oh, yes, most of them had to turn back under fire. The Germans are well entrenched and keep a careful lookout, of course.
Pause again. It sounds to me as though this is a task that does not demand sending in, say, a platoon or a couple of boatfuls of jacks. Stealth is what'll be required, not from a large party.
I think the three of us, Jenkins, Mzingeli and myself, are probably the ideal number.
When will you want us to start?
Soon as possible. I'm fed up with keeping half of the British Navy in the Southern Ocean steaming up and down doing guard duty at the mouth of the Delta. I want to get in after this bloody ship as soon as you can come up with the information we require. Can you? Soon?
Do you have good maps of the Delta?
Wouldn't say they're exactly comprehensive or up to date, but you can have what we have.
You might even find better snooping around the back streets of Mombasa. Very well, Admiral. I will need, say, 3 days to find the right light craft, no naval longboats, thank you, and to provision, and then we'll be off. I presume we can have a ship to drop us off at the mouth of the Delta. The Admiral sniffed.
My dear fellow, you can have a whole bloody fleet. They're all steaming about, looking for something to do. Take your pick.
Very well, sir. Thank you. We will do our best. The two men shook hands, and Fonthill swung on his heel and walked out into the hot sun, his head swimming, but his heart singing. Just the sort of task he revelled in. Out with his two tried and tested comrades, on their own, behind or crossing enemy lines. Then he frowned. He hoped to God that Mzingeli could guide them through the channels. Without that sort of knowledge, they would be lost, metaphorically and literally. Back at the hotel, he summoned his two colleagues to meet in his room. Alice was out on some mission of her own. He described the task and gave them a brief rundown on the recent attempts to winkle out the German ship from her jungle shell. Then he paused. Jenkins and Mzingeli remained silent. A tough assignment, lads, I know. And much will depend upon you, Mzingeli. You said the other day that you'd fished in those waters. The tracker slowly nodded. He rarely did anything quickly.
Oh, yes, of course, he said eventually.
But it was a long time ago. Perhaps 30 years. Yes, but will you remember the channels? Another pause.
Probably not. But I think I know a man who help us.
Ah, splendid. Who is he?
His fisherman, who live there. I fish with him years ago. Local native. His son lives in Mombasa. I meet him the other day. He says his father still alive and fishing. If there is big ship hiding upriver, he will know where.
Jenkins lifted his eyebrows.
Blimey, Jelly. That's the most I've heard you say in years. You must be getting verbal the shits.
Fonthill stifled a smile. Will you be able to find this fellow?
Oh, I think so. Long time ago, I see him, but his son say he is in same village, near mouth of little rivers. Yes, I think I find him.
That's good. Now, he was interrupted by Jenkins.
One thing, Baxter.
Yes?
Exactly how do we go up these rivers, then?
That's what I was coming to. Zingeli, we will need native craft, canoes or whatever they use in the Delta, probably two. One for us and one for our supplies. Where would be the best place to buy them, do you think? I'd be worried about trying to get them in the Delta. Word could get out to the Germans. They're bound to have made contact and even have working arrangements with the local natives to supply food, etc. to the ship.
Yes, of course. But I see plenty of small boats here in Mombasa, like those used in the Delta. We buy them here, I think.
Good. Now, again, he was interrupted by Jenkins.
Would these be very small boats, then, Jelly?
Oh, yes. 3-5-2 Bach.
A faint smile began to creep across the usually impassive face of the black man.
Quite small. Trouble is they easily over 10. So we must be careful.
And,
Jenkins's own features now assumed a nonchalant air.
Would there be any, crocodiles in these rivers, then?
Mzingeli's face had resumed its normal impassivity, but there was a sparkle to his black eyes.
Oh, teeming with them, yes.
And, how big would these crocs be, then?
Oh, very big, 3-5-2 Bach. Man-eaters.
A silence fell on the little room, and Fonthill bit his lip to hold back a smile. Jenkins shrugged his shoulders.
Not that I'm worried about crocs, Luku. Seen plenty of them in my time. Stood on one once in Egypt.
Mzingeli shook his head slowly.
They're alligators in Nile. These crocodiles, much more fierce.
Tiny beads of perspiration were now standing out on Jenkins's forehead.
Well, Bach, it's no concern of mine. I don't worry about them now. Once you've seen one, you've seen them all. Just don't fall in the bleeding water. That's my motto.
Quite right, too. Simon now allowed his grin to lighten his features. Firstly, Mzingeli, see if you can buy two reasonably unsinkable, he turned the grin on to Jenkins, craft in the harbour, the sort that would be used by the natives in the Delta. Say you want them for fishing. He turned to Jenkins. 3-5-2, sniff around the marketplace. You're the best scavenger I've ever met, and see if you can find three reasonably serviceable German Mauser rifles.
Oh, no.
Jenkins's face fell.
Why do we want them old things when we've got our much better Lee Enfields?
Simon sighed. Because if we're questioned by the Germans, the British guns would be a dead giveaway. There should be plenty of Mausers coming across the border from German East Africa, and if we're stopped, we can say we bought them there. Mzingeli's forehead now carried a faint frown.
If we stopped, who do we say we are? We're not local natives of the Delta, that would be clear.
Quite so. I think we'd better be Portuguese. The border of their colony is not far away. We'd have to say that we were looking to set up a franchise in the Delta for fishing when the war is over, and we're prospecting to judge the fishing stocks. What do you think? Does that sound plausible?
Not very.
The black man gave a rare smile, revealing his array of white teeth of tombstone proportions.
Might work with stupid Germans. We must make sure we're only captured by stupid men.
Oh, I can arrange that. Now, I must withdraw money from the bank. Stay here, I won't be a moment. It's only next door. Just one more thing. Simon put a hand to his brow and looked a little embarrassed.
What's that?
Asked Jenkins.
Shall we go in on a battleship, then? Much better idea.
No. Now, listen. I don't want Alice to know anything about this. If she hears what we're up to, she will want to come with us, and that is impossible. He blew out his cheeks. I don't want another row with her. They're more debilitating than the actual work itself.
What do we do, then? Just say we're paddling up the bloody ocean, fishing for sardines?
Simon frowned. I'll have to think about it, but say nothing now. Stay here until I come back with the money.
He returned shortly with a bundle of notes, which he shared with the others.
Off you go, see what you can get. But whatever you do, don't spread suspicion. Alice tells me that this town is buzzing with German spies. Oh, and Mzingeli, see if you can pick up an up-to-date map of the Delta showing the channels. If you are questioned, say it's for your master who collects this sort of thing.
The thought of what to tell Alice now consumed Simon. In the end, he decided that they would just slip away after she'd left to do her researching. He would leave a non-committal note and then write to her more fully from the British warship. The Admiral made arrangements for one of his ships to pick them up, and Simon dispatched Mzingeli once again into the markets to buy some old clothes, cotton shirts, trousers, bandanas for their heads, that Portuguese fishermen might wear. And he also shopped at the local pharmacist himself for a stock of anti-malaria tablets. In the Delta channels, overhung with jungle vegetation, he felt that mosquitoes would be as big a threat as the Germans. Within 2 days, the trio were ready. Importantly, the resourceful Mzingeli, who was turning into as good a provisioner as the arch-scavenger Jenkins, had been able to find an old Arab map that looked remarkably detailed. It showed 4 main channels opening out into the delta, among the mass of streams and rivulets that made a patchwork quilt of the area. Each of them looked wide enough to offer passage to the Königsberg. But how deep were they, and which would take them far enough into the interior? Simon scribbled a brief note for Alice. Been called away without notice to carry out a scouting job in land. It's just routine and not dangerous. We'll write more fully later. Not to worry. Love you, Simon. Then they boarded a small steam launch and headed out to where their long, low, grey warship waited for them, fully cold and with steam up. Looking back at the bustling, steamy port they were leaving, Fonthill wondered how long it would be before he would see it, and his wife, again. Chapter 6. The three of them huddled together in the clinging early morning mist in the lead canoe while Mizango, Mzingeli's old friend from fishing days, paddled behind in the craft carrying their supplies. They'd picked him up the preceding day from one of the villages on the banks of the Kikunja Channel, on the seaward edge of the delta. He was a very old, thin, wiry man with white, tightly curled hair and an engaging, toothless grin. He'd willingly agreed to serve Fonthill because, he confessed through Mzingeli, he disliked the Germans, who ordered him about and had flogged his nephew for refusing to sell them fish.
"Sounds a promising bloke," commented Jenkins at the time. "Give him one tooth and a vest and he could be a British general."
Today, however, 352 was in a less amenable mood. 2 crocodiles had swum past their fragile canoes that morning and hauled their scaly lengths up into the mangrove roots, causing their vessels to rock in the swell they'd created. He had gripped the sides of the canoe until his knuckles gleamed white in the half-light and perspiration stood out on his brow.
"Abach," called out Mzingeli cheerily, "if you not interfere with them, they not interfere with you." "I have no bleeding intention of interfering with them. But do they know that?"
Mizango had quickly acknowledged that he knew of a big 3-funneled ship moored at the Salale Island, deep in the Simba-Uranga Channel. But he also knew that she had slipped her moorings and steamed deeper into the delta. Where she was now, he had no idea, but he cheerily insisted that he could find her. They had therefore paddled across the mouth of the delta and camped at the mouth of this channel, near where the old British steamer Newbridge had been sunk to block the exit. Now, since before dawn, they'd been paddling up the channel, thinking it best to establish where the cruiser had originally moored and trace her passage from there. They'd been dropped by their warship at the mouth of the delta, and now entered the channel between 2 narrow headlands, on both of which they'd caught a glimpse of cleverly camouflaged German heavy machine gun posts,
their snub snouts pointing across the channel. Fonthill had been apprehensive that they might be challenged, but so near the open sea. There were many similar fishing boats paddling or sailing to and fro even at this early hour, some laying nets near the shore, others casting single lines, and they excited no curiosity from the watchers at their hidden posts. Now, however, the channel, though seemingly quite deep, was beginning to narrow, and Mizango indicated that on their starboard side they were approaching the big inland island of Salale, where the Königsberg had been lying up until comparatively recently. "Let's land on that bit of beach on the island there," Simon pointed to starboard. "I wouldn't be surprised if the Germans had left a fortified position where the ship had been moored. I'd rather steal up on it and take a look before we try and paddle past. But take one of the nets, just in case they spot us and question us." Quietly, they slipped their craft ashore, paddling carefully between two hippopotamuses on the way. Drawing up their canoes and hiding them under bushes, they began to make their way through the thick undergrowth along the shoreline. By now, they looked nothing like a British naval party on a spying mission. Mzingele and Mizango now wore only loincloths and loose turbans wound around their heads. Fonthill and Jenkins were now both deeply tanned so that their ethnic origins were hard to place. They wore sandals, torn khaki shorts, grimy cotton shirts, and had forsaken their white man's pith helmets in favour of scraps of fabric wound around their heads to protect them from the sun. Mzingele and Mizango now led the way, carrying the big prawn net between them, and the two white men followed, holding their rifles by their slings. It was not easy going, for they were forced to pick their way over and through the great arching mangrove roots that marked the shoreline. Overhead, a thousand chattering monkeys seemed to scream at their intrusion and warn of their progress. Snakes, large and small, slithered over the roots and into the water to give them passage. The river mist had now risen to be replaced by a steamy, shirt-clinging heat.
"Blimey," muttered Jenkins. "I think it would be better to swim. Not that I can, mind you."
Fonthill hissed and held up his hand. The others clustered around him.
"If we're stopped and questioned," he whispered, "remember that we're two Portuguese fishermen who are investigating the prospects for prawn fishing here if we gain permission from the German authorities."
He slapped his hip pocket. "Jenkins and I have rough-and-ready forged passports that I had made in Mombasa, so I hope the Germans will believe us. Now, Mzingele, ask Mizango if he thinks the Germans will speak Swahili. If so, you do the talking for us. If one of them speaks Portuguese, we're going to be in trouble, but we have to take that risk. If necessary, I'll ask, in my best Portuguese accent, if they speak English. But I don't want to get taken, so tread with great care through this damned jungle. I just want to observe their armament and placement and then get back to the canoe. If there's no German post here, then let's see what we can pick up from where the cruiser was moored." Simon realized that he had no indication of where the Königsberg had originally moored. For all he knew, the three of them could be picking their way between these damned mangrove roots and slapping away mosquitoes for the rest of the day. Perhaps they should have paddled on a little further. Then Mzingele, who was leading, froze and held up his hand. He gestured for the others to slip into the jungle and inched his way forward alone, brushing aside the overhanging creepers with great care. He had disappeared for at least 3 minutes before he reappeared and joined Fonthill in the undergrowth. He was crouched down close to Simon so that his body odour was distinctive.
"There is German post a few yards ahead," he whispered. "They have big gun and one machine gun set onto wooden planks, put onto edge of jungle and hidden by vines, and so on, all pointing across water."
"How many men?"
"Not sure. I counted 5. All white men. Could not see any askaris."
"Good. There must be sailors from the cruiser. We can't be all that far away."
"What we do now, Nkos?"
"Take me where I can see for myself." Together, the two men carefully picked their way forward until Mzingele indicated that they should fall onto hands and knees and crawl forward. Fonthill parted the creepers that hung all around them until he could see ahead. He saw the breech of a small to medium-sized artillery piece, perhaps a 12-pounder, its muzzle pointed away from them, snugly mounted on a wooden base and with a camouflage net hung overhead, strewn with foliage. Flanking it on either side were two Maxim-type heavy machine guns. The 12-man crew, dressed in white tropical uniforms and wearing the distinctive tasseled sailor caps of the German Imperial Navy, were sitting at their weapons, smoking and all looking out onto the channel. Then three more men sauntered into sight, sat and produced playing cards.
"Back now," hissed Simon. "I've seen enough."
They retreated as carefully as they'd come and rejoined the other two.
"Have they got a battleship tucked away there then, Bach, sir?"
inquired Jenkins. "No, but if all their posts are as well-equipped and manned as this one, then I can quite understand why our small craft couldn't get through."
"So, what do we do now then?"
"Back to the boats. I don't want to risk being blown out of the water by some trigger-happy German rating." "We'll hide away as best we can in case they patrol this bit of shoreline. Then, after darkness, but before the moon comes up, we'll paddle gently past them on the other side of the channel. And if anyone makes a sound, he will feed the crocodiles."
"Ah."
Jenkins nodded somberly.
"I shall be very, very, very exceedingly quiet then."
Back at the little beach, they covered the boats more satisfactorily, and then found what little comfort they could in the jungle, slapping at the mosquitoes and drinking from their quinine-spliced water bottles. The discomfort was extreme, but the dusk fell quickly, and when it came, they were ready. Their prawn nets prominently displayed in case they were challenged, they paddled to the far side of the channel and crept upstream, hugging the shoreline. Only one small, raw flame spluttering, an attempt no doubt to defeat the mosquitoes afflicting the lookout, showed where the gunpoint was situated. Intuitively, Fonthill ducked his head and averted his gaze from the far shore, as silently each man in the two canoes dipped his paddle into the water, reaching forward to gain maximum impetus from each stroke. Agonizingly slow, it seemed, the little craft crept past the gun emplacements until they passed a bend in the channel and had reached safe water.
"Well done," whispered Simon.
"We'll keep on for another hour, then stop and bed down for the night. I want to explore further upstream. The cruiser obviously came this way. 352.
"Bach, sir."
"Keep taking soundings with that pole of yours, every 200 yards or so. I want to chart the water depths as we go."
"Aye, aye, Captain."
They were up again well before dawn. Sleeping in what were virtually African water meadows presented little opportunity for sound slumber, and they continued their passage down the southeastern side of Salale Island, and had put perhaps 2 miles of the muddy water of the channel behind them, when, suddenly, they were challenged from the shore.
"Wer sind Sie? Und wohin gehen Sie?"
"Damn," swore Simon, caught napping.
"Now remember, we two are Portuguese. Explain that in Swahili, Mzingeli." The tracker did so, and a man appeared from between the mangrove trees. He was wearing a grubby German naval uniform and was pointing a rifle at them. He shouted at them again in German,
"Kommen Sie ans Ufer, sonst schieße ich."
They could not understand him, but he gestured to the shore with his rifle, and his meaning was clear. "Very well," muttered Simon. "If he doesn't speak Swahili, then I'll have to try my Portuguese English. Paddle in, boys." "Are there bullets up the spouts of the Mausers, 352?
"Oh, yes, Bach, sir."
"Well, we'll try and keep them in reach. But I don't want to fight unless we absolutely have to. The bloody cruiser may be just around the corner, and we might be just a bit outnumbered if we start a fight. Zingele,
of course.
As we paddle in, keep shouting to him in Swahili that you are acting as guides for 2 Portuguese fishermen.
"Yes, of course."
As they neared the shore, 2 more sailors appeared carrying rifles, and as the canoe grounded onto the gritty shingle, they surrounded the craft and gestured with their rifles for them to get out. Simon held up his hands and said,
"Nein sprachen sie Deutsch."
Mzingele was still speaking in Swahili to the first German, who scowled and shook his head. Then a 4th man, in officer's uniform, materialized from among the trees and nodded to the seamen to lower their weapons. Fonthill took a deep breath. If the officer spoke Portuguese, they were done for.
"I speak some English," he said.
The officer nodded.
"Then tell me who you are and what you are doing in Sherman territory."
His English was perfect. Simon fumbled in his pocket and produced his bogus passport and gestured to Jenkins to do the same.
"Manuel da Silva,"
he said, bowing slightly. He nodded to Jenkins and added,
"Mina colega, Federico Ramirez. We Portuguese fishermen."
The German inspected both passports with a cursory air and handed them back.
"What are you doing here?" "We work for big Portuguese fishing company in Portuguese East Africa. We are exploring this water to find enough prawns here to fish here after war, see?"
And he bent down into the canoe and held up the large net. The officer remained looking at them, slowly taking in the baggy torn shorts, the dirty shirts and the scraps of fabric tied around their heads. Then he shook his head.
"I don't believe you. Come."
He drew a revolver from its holster at his belt and indicated that they should follow him. The little party, with the three sailors at the rear, threaded its way over the mangrove roots until they reached the rear end of a rough wooden shelter that was draped with a camouflage net, through which had been thrust stalks of palm and other leaves. Simon realized that the post had been situated just around the point of a small promontory, which they would have reached with a few more strokes of their paddles. A large machine gun was mounted on a tripod inside the shack and, quite hidden from the outside, commanded this part of the river. The officer was young, with a fair golden moustache and embryonic beard, but the most distinguishing features were his eyes. They were startlingly light blue, giving his face a cold and even cruel appearance. He seemed to be in command of the post. He gestured for Fonthill and Jenkins to sit on two stools and the others to squat on the floor of bamboo canes that projected over the water. He lowered himself into an old armchair.
"Now," he said, "I think you are British spies trying to find the Königsberg. You might as well tell the truth now. We will beat it out of you if you don't."
He shouted a command in German, and one of the sailors immediately reached up to the roof of the shack and produced a bullhide whip. From the corner of his eye, Simon saw Jenkins's fingers creep towards the large knife that always hung from his belt. He hoped the Welshman would do nothing impulsive, for they were well outnumbered. He rolled his eyes in simulated terror.
"We no lie," he said. "Portuguese men want to fish here. These are German territorial waters, and Portugal is now at war with Germany. You could not have been given permission to enter these waters. Show me your accreditation to do so."
Fonthill allowed his jaw to drop.
"Accreditation, sir. What that?"
The German sighed. Simon began for the first time to think that their story might be believed. He knew that many of the fishermen out at the entrance to the delta were Portuguese. Some of them were fishing for prawns at the mouth of the Kikunja Channel, impervious to, and perhaps even unaware of, the fact that war had been declared between Germany and Portugal, England's oldest ally.
"It means the papers giving you permission to enter these waters."
"Ah, papers. See, I have some in the boat."
"Go and get them."
He issued an order in German, and the sailor with the bullwhip stepped forward and gestured back the way they'd come. Fonthill took a deep breath. His escort, supremely arrogant, had left his rifle behind, relying only on the bullwhip as a weapon. In referring to his papers, Simon was merely playing for time, but now there was a chance he could overpower his guardian. Or could he? As he shuffled through the door, he assessed him. Medium height, a paunch that hung over his belt, a good sign. Much younger, of course, but not looking very fit. Like Jenkins, Simon wore a knife at his belt. It was useful for cutting back undergrowth. It would have to play a more sinister role now. Deliberately slouching, he made his way towards the boat, stumbling here and there over the mangrove roots. His thoughts raced. even if he could unearth one of the Mausers hidden in the canoe swiftly enough to fire before the sailor did. The report would alert the others and fetch them running. No. He gulped. It would have to be silent, cold steel. Ah, Jenkins would have been much better at this dreadful business. They reached the boat and Simon racked his brains to remember where there might be official-looking papers in the craft. They carried nothing to betray their identity, of course, so there was little that would serve the purpose. There were only the maps. Yet maps always looked like maps, but at least these were carefully folded. Perhaps they would serve if he could distract the German's attention. He retrieved them from the boat, held them up for the sailor's inspection as he stepped over onto the shingle, then deliberately slipped, sending them scattering at the German's feet. The man instinctively looked down. In one quick movement, Fonthill withdrew his knife, flung himself upon the sailor, and plunged the knife into his stomach, putting his hand over the man's mouth as he did so. The two went sprawling. And as he fell, the German banged his head onto a mangrove root projecting from the shingle, half stunning him. The impact threw Simon to one side so that his hand fell from the sailor's mouth, but the man emitted only a low groan. Quickly, Fonthill withdrew the knife and, gritting his teeth in disgust, thrust the blade into the man's throat, sending blood over his own face and breast. Within seconds, the German was dead. Slowly, Simon stood, breathing heavily. He stood listening for a moment, but only the chattering of monkeys overhead met his ear. He turned to the canoe and extracted the three Mauser rifles. They were not exactly state-of-the-art weapons, but they were modern enough to be fitted with six cartridge magazines each. He checked to ensure that each rifle had a round inserted into its breech, and stepping gingerly over the body of the dead sailor, he wrinkled his nose as he noted that flies were already gorging themselves on the man's gaping wounds. He began making his way back to the hut. At the doorway, he took a deep breath, put the butt of the rifle to his shoulder and sprang through the opening. "Drop your guns!" he shouted. The officer still had his revolver in his hand, and involuntarily he fired at Fonthill from his lap. It was his last act. As his bullet crashed into the doorframe, Simon's shot took him in the chest and he crashed to the floor. Working the bolt on his Mauser to slip another round into the breech, Fonthill swung round to face the others. He was not as quick, however, as Jenkins. The Welshman, knife in hand, hurled himself at the nearest sailor, who cannoned into the man next to him, sending them both to the ground. One of the rifles cracked, sending a round into the roof of the shack. Then Jenkins's knife rose and fell twice, and all became silent.
"Well done, 352, gasped Fonthill, subsiding into a chair. "I think that's enough killing for one day."
Mzingerle moved lithely to the three Germans, put three fingers to each man's jugular artery, and nodded. "All dead, in course," he said. Jenkins slowly got to his feet, breathing heavily.
"Blimey,"
he said, nodding to where the elderly Mizango, his mouth hanging open, was staring wide-eyed at the bodies.
"Old Django, yeah, probably thinks we do this every Thursday."
He raised his eyebrows at Simon's blood-stained shirt.
"Good heavens, Bach, sir. You look as though you've been in a bit of a fight. But well done. I was just wondering how I could finish off this lot on me own and then come and give you a hand. See, I might have known you could look after yourself. Are you all right?"
Fonthill nodded dismally.
"A knife, I'm afraid. And I hated doing it. Mind you," he looked up at Jenkins, "I think the bastard would have used that whip on us. Now,"
he looked round. "It takes three men to man a heavy Maxim like this, so, including the officer, we must have accounted for the full crew of this post. If there were any more, they would have come running by now." He looked round at the others. "Sorry, gentlemen, but I think we must dispose of the bodies. When there is no report back from this post to the German ship, I reckon the captain will send a boat to check. I don't want to alert them by letting them find the human debris." He thought for a moment. "Can't bury them among these mangrove roots. I'm afraid it will have to be the river. And the crocodiles."
"Oh, bloody hell, Bach, sir."
Jenkins's face was a picture of misery.
"We can't do that to the poor bastards. It'll encourage them awful crocs, too, look you. Can't we find a bit of sand or something and put them in there?"
No, sorry, no time. Go on, first the bodies, then the machine gun. We'll put them all midstream and weigh them down. 352, you're excused this duty. Stay here and keep watch.
Ah, now that's very kind, Bach, sir. I couldn't feed them to the crocs. I really couldn't.
No, Simon nodded. But first you can help Mzingeli and I carry this damned machine gun. Let's put a couple of rounds into the thing to make sure it's put out of action completely in case the Germans try and recover it. They're probably treasuring every weapon they have, being so far from their home base. Come on, let's get moving. Well, within the hour, the two canoes were on their way, gingerly dipping a rag into the river. When the bodies had been deposited, there was an ominous swelling of the surface of the water near the boat. Fonthill had managed to clean most, at least, of the blood from his shirt and face. He was worried, however, that they'd blundered so blindly into the machine-gun post. If the German captain was as efficient as he seemed to be, there would be many other posts to circumnavigate before they found the Königsberg. He lifted his hand. "I don't think we should continue paddling during daylight hours," he said. "I don't want to run into another German post. We'll pull over at the next clearing in the jungle we can see and lay up for the rest of the day. I want to talk to Mizango, anyway." Once they'd hidden the canoes, a fire was lit, a kettle was hung over it, and the four gathered around it and sipped tea.
"I don't want to go on more or less blindly paddling up these channels, offering ourselves as bait to the German defences in the jungle. And there's so many of these damned rivers that it'll take us months to investigate them all. Mzingeli, can you please ask Mizango if there are any native villages tucked away on the channels?"
For a few moments, the two black men huddled over their tin mugs, talking to each other in Swahili. Then Mzingeli turned back to Simon.
"He said that, yes, there are native fishing villages on some of the islands of the delta, but they will probably be selling fish to the big ship, so may not tell us where she is."
Good point. Never mind, can he take us to the nearest of these villages? The people there will surely know where the blasted ship is, and I'm prepared to pay for the information. Again, the two men became locked in discussion. Ever since the blood-stained Simon had appeared in the doorway of the machine-gun post, like some avenging angel from hell, and had shot the German officer, and Jenkins had so quickly dispatched the two other men, the old man had hardly taken his eyes off both of them, his jaw hanging down in, what, awe, fear, admiration? Now, Mzingeli reported that the nearest village known to Mizango was a good day's paddling away. But the chief there knew most things that happened in the maze of inlets and channels that made up the delta, and he might know where the big ship lay.
"Umph." Jenkins tugged at his moustache in exasperation. "Now why didn't he say that in the first place?"
Fonthill shook his head. "My fault," he said. "The Admiral had advised that we should investigate this, the biggest channel, first.
I should have thought it through. Of course the natives would know if a damn great three-funneled man-of-war was parked in their backyard. We should have visited this chief first. Thank Mizango, and ask him to take us there as soon as it gets dark. Will he know the way to go in the darkness?"
Mzingeli nodded. "He thinks so." "Good. Let's have something to eat and leave as soon as we can. It would be good to get as near as we can to the village before dawn. Let's paddle on the far side." He allowed himself a smile. "Where the giant crocs are." Jenkins snorted.
"Everyone knows I'm not in the least afraid of the bloody things, Bach, sir. It's just that I can't swim, see? If I could, I could just swim underneath their bellies, sticking me knife and Bob's your uncle."
"Of course, old chap. Of course." Once they were afloat again, the heat at last subsided. And this time, led by Mizango, they cleared the bottom of the long Salale Island and turned to the northwest to meet yet another channel. They found later that it was a subsidiary of the Simba Uranga, where they turned to the north. The night was dark, and Fonthill attempted to follow with his compass the twists and turns they took. Before he gave up in disgust, they'd travelled at least 4 miles before a glow to the east prompted him to call a halt once more. Again, they spent an agonizing day slapping at the mosquitoes and trying to find some sort of sleeping space between the mangrove roots. They took to the water again in the dusk, and after 2 hours of paddling, Mizango held up his paddle and pointed ahead. The embers of flickering fires could be seen through the trees.
"It's the village," whispered Mzingeli.
"Good," Simon wiped his forehead. "We can't enter it at night. Tell Mizango to find us a spot to camp nearby. Then we'll find the chief as soon as people are about." Sleeping at night in the jungle was almost as bad as by day for the fear of snakes. Mizango warned that many were dangerous, kept them awake, and forced them to light a small fire. As soon as dawn broke, they paddled their way into a small inlet where dugout canoes were drawn up. There they waited while Mizango and Mzingeli disappeared along a beaten path. They returned 20 minutes later, bringing with them a wizened beanstick of a man, who, with his tightly curled white hair and toothless grin, seemed a replica of Mizango. Everyone sat in a semicircle on the grey shingle while the three black men spoke animatedly. Eventually, Mzingeli turned to Fonthill.
"Yes, Chief says that big ship with 3 funnels and plenty guns is moored not far from here, but deeper into channel."
"Splendid." Fonthill pulled out from under his shirt a small leather bag and dipped into it, producing 5 German coins. He handed them to the chief, who grabbed them eagerly. "Now ask him if he can draw in the shingle a rough map showing where we are now and where the big ship is moored. If he can, I will double the coins." The chief gave his toothless grin and nodded. Then, with a long black finger, he traced a rough outline of a big entrance to the delta, which Simon identified from the old map he'd bought in Mombasa as the mouth of the Kikunja Channel. Then he traced a line down the channel to the southwest to an outline of an island. His finger moved to the left and then sharply to the south, past another island. At the southern end of the island, he made a cross.
"German ship," said Mzingeli.
The old man grinned again and began talking again, this time frowning and jabbing his finger into the shingle in emphasis.
"He say," said Mzingeli, "that big ship is protected by small boats carrying guns. It is well hidden in trees, and there are many posts on mainland and islands where Germans are hidden with guns. He don't think it possible to get there by canoe without Germans shooting at us."
Fonthill nodded and thought for a moment. He leant forward and indicated the big island at the southern tip of which the Königsberg was moored. "What's this island called?"
"Kikunja."
"Ah, yes, after the channel. Is it possible for us to go ashore there on the island to the north of where the ship is and walk through the jungle to see the ship for ourselves?" Another palaver followed. Then Mzingeli,
"He said that it is possible, but very difficult to get through jungle. We would need to follow island shoreline down, but very tangled and so on. We'll take time."
Fonthill nodded. He handed over 5 more coins and sat thinking. Then, "Sounds too difficult to me. Tell him we'll go back to the mouth of the delta and find our ships and go home. Thank him for his help." The chief folded the coins in his large fist, nodded and grinned to everyone, and then stood and ambled away.
"Blamey," grunted Jenkins. "We're not giving up now, are we?"
Simon shook his head. "Of course not. Just in case the old boy was going to run to the Germans. Valued customers for fish, I should think. I wanted to set him off our track. We'll paddle by night down to the end of this island and then go ashore on the next island where the Königsberg is moored. Then we'll take a stroll through the jungle and take a look at the ship. From now on, 352, it is particularly important that you keep on taking regular soundings with your pole. We must report on how far up channel the big ships can go."
"Very good, Bach, sir. And I shall look forward to the refreshing walk through this miserable, bleeding jungle, so I will."
They spent the rest of the day trying to rest among the mangrove roots on the edge of the village. Fonthill found it impossible to sleep. The sight of the blood gushing from the German sailor's throat and the ease with which his knife had slipped into the soft flesh kept returning to him and making his stomach turn. He and Jenkins had been involved in so many battles and hand-to-hand encounters over the years that he was a little surprised at his revulsion still at killing, that his taste for it was muted when he killed at long range with the bullet. But ever since the battles of Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift, the necessity of using cold steel always reminded him of those frantic 2 days when he saw soldiers' bowels ripped open by the assegais of the Zulu and the distinctive ikwa sound made by the twisting and withdrawing of the blades after the killings. Inevitably, his thoughts turned to Alice. He had scribbled a further, fuller letter to her from the ship and asked that it be delivered to her when the vessel returned to Mombasa, which was imminent. She would surely have received the letter by now. He'd explained that their mission had been extended and that it would be some little time before he and his two companions returned to the port. He assured her that the task ahead of them was not unduly dangerous, just rather arduous and wearying. She should not, under any circumstance, attempt to discover the nature of the mission as it was cloaked in secrecy and any talk of it could threaten its successful conclusion. He turned and pushed the end of his headscarf over his face to keep the flies away. Surely the letter would prevent Alice from sniffing at their coattails. His mind idled its way to thinking of their adopted son, Sunil. The boy who'd been such a comfort to them over the last decade was now, of course, a subaltern fighting on the Western Front. Even in East Africa, the news of the awful carnage of the fighting in Europe had reached them. It was said that the average lifetime of a second lieutenant in the trenches there was less than a month. God, he hoped he was safe. They'd lost their first son in childbirth, and this boy had become precious to them both. He had also turned out to be a first-class soldier, so that was one comfort. Please, God, he prayed. Keep him safe. Keep him safe. The sun went down, and it was with relief that they launched the two canoes and headed at first to the north. Then, when well out of sight of the village, they turned and paddled their way to the south, keeping close inshore to reduce the risk of them being spotted out in mid-channel, now brightly lit by the moon. Eventually they rounded the edge of the island that housed the village and paddled quickly across to Kikunja. They must be nearing the Königsberg now. Which meant, pondered Simon, that they would soon be coming abreast of the shore gun emplacement set up in the jungle to protect her. Better not risk going too far by canoe down the channel. He peered to the shoreline on his left. It seemed impenetrable. How on earth were they going to cut their way through it without being discovered? Eventually, another little inlet with its own beach appeared, the shingle glinting in the moonlight. He signalled for the two canoes to pull into it. They followed the usual drill. Mzingeli, the master tracker, with a tread as light as a panther's, disappearing into the jungle, to ensure that there were no Germans entrenched nearby, and also to find a path of some sort near the shoreline, and the others pulling up the canoes and hiding them as far as possible among the mangrove roots. The smell from the latter, or perhaps from the stagnant water between them, added to the general feeling of dismay at the task ahead of them. This was reinforced when Mzingeli returned to say that he could find no path through the undergrowth and the roots. "Oh, well," said Simon, "it's a bad thing in that it's going to make the going very difficult, but good in that it shows there's not much traffic hereabouts." He took out his compass. "Come on, at least there's plenty of light from the moon. But tread carefully." The next 2 hours were amongst the worst of Fonthill's life. He did his best to follow the shoreline, catching the occasional glimpse of bright water between the tree trunks, but sometimes his compass bearing took them deeper into the jungle so that they had to use their one machete to cut a way through to make any progress at all. They all slipped and stumbled over the cursed roots, sometimes splashing into the water between them, Perspiration coated their bodies, attracting myriads of insects, and thorns tore at what was left of the clothing, causing blood to trickle down their skins, attracting yet more parasites. The chattering of the monkeys preceded them, and the squawking of parakeets and other birds, fluttering up as they came near, prompted Fonthill to feel that the jungle itself was conspiring to warn the Germans of their approach. Eventually, the jungle began to thin out slightly, and a beaten path of sorts materialized by the side of the channel. Here, Fonthill sent Mzingerle on ahead to scout while the others took a much-needed rest perched on the mangrove roots protruding from the black, fetid water.
"Big gun post up ahead," reported the tracker, his teeth flashing in the early dawn light. "It blocks path. We must go into jungle to get round it."
"Oh, bugger," muttered Jenkins.
"Why don't you three leave me here, keeping these mangroves warm? You can pick me up on your way back."
"No talking from now on," whispered Simon. "You'd better lead, Mzingerle. I'll be close behind with a compass." It took them at least 45 minutes to circle around the gun emplacement and then return to the shoreline. As they did so, Mzingerle held up his hand and beckoned Fonthill forward. Simon knelt at his side, and, parting the fronds ahead of him, revealed in the early light of dawn the long, menacing outline of a grey-painted warship, moored close up to the shore so that she looked vast, her three funnels and menacing gun barrels draped in camouflage netting, a black and red eagle hanging listlessly from its flagstaff on her stern. He grinned, turned, and gestured for Jenkins to join them.
"Look," he said, "it's the Königsberg. As I live and breathe, we've found the bastard at last."
Chapter 7 Alice read Simon's second letter, delivered that morning from HMS Weymouth, on her return to Mombasa with a growing sense of fury. Why on earth couldn't he tell her where he was going? A routine job, indeed. Was she a blabbermouth who could not keep a secret? Was she just another correspondent who couldn't be trusted? Damn it, was she not his wife who would be concerned about his safety? Why the hell, then, couldn't he tell her, at least to what part of the country it was that his mission was taking him? Country. She mused. Country. Presumably, the Weymouth had taken him there. The notepaper of his letter was headed from the wardroom of that ship. It should not be difficult to find out what had been her destination before returning home to port. She sat for a moment, thinking. Then she put on her wide-brimmed sun hat, wrapped around its base a blue-grey scarf that she knew complemented her eyes, left the hotel and headed for the harbour. Using her binoculars, she scanned the ships in the harbour. Yes, there was Weymouth, anchored quite far out. And yes, what luck, there was her pinnace, clearly marked, heading into the harbour from the ship, quite close into the quay now. She strode forward. A young midshipman sprang ashore. "Excuse me, Lieutenant," said Alice, doing her best to summon up a winning smile. "Sorry to bother you, but I wonder if you could help me." The young man beamed and saluted. "I'm only a midshipman, madam, but I will do my best. How can I help?" Alice fluttered her eyelashes. "Oh, my goodness, you look much older than that, but thank you. I'm searching for Lieutenant Commander Hawkins, and I've stupidly left the name of his ship at the hotel. Would he be serving on the Weymouth by any chance?" "No, ma'am. I don't know an officer of that name." "Oh, that's strange. I'm sure it was the Weymouth. His ship had come in from Cape Town. Was that your last destination, pray?" "No, ma'am, we've just come back from the Rufiji Delta, which is certainly south of here, but not that far south." "Oh, I'm so sorry to have detained you. I must return to my hotel and ascertain the name of his ship." "Thank you so much," the young man saluted. "Not at all, madam. Good day." Alice walked away, thinking quickly. The Rufiji Delta. Of course, the Königsberg. They'd sent Simon Jenkins and Mzingerle to find the big German cruiser that was tucked away somewhere in that network of channels and islands. What better team to seek her out and pin her down than that wonderful trio? Her brow darkened. What was it Simon had written? Something to the effect that their task would be arduous but not dangerous. What rubbish! Of course it would be dangerous. She knew that the German ship had defied all efforts to sink her, from bombing attacks from the air to light craft assaults along the channels, and that she was defended by gun emplacements in the jungle, armed with artillery pieces and heavy machine guns. Even the magnificent trio could not lightly undertake the task of finding her new hiding place, and then planning how to sink her. Alice sat for a moment in shade offered by palm fronds, and closed her eyes, the better to think. At least Mzingeli would be invaluable on this mission. His knowledge of the jungle would be an ideal complement to the guts and courage of Jenkins and the leadership skills of Simon. Jungle. From the little she'd read of the delta, she knew that the islands and the mainland fringing it were dominated by thick undergrowth, mangrove swamps and forest. They would not try to wade through that sort of terrain in quest of the Königsberg. It would take them a month of Sundays to make any progress. Alice brushed away a fly. No, they would explore the channels by boat, just as dangerous but quicker and more likely to bring success. Then a slow smile crept across her sunburnt features. What a story. The search for the German cruiser had captured the imagination of all the readers of newspapers back home. If Simon could find her, and if she could find him first and be with him when the discovery was made, it would be the scoop of a lifetime. On a par no better than Stanley's discovery of Livingston 40 years or so ago. She stood, her mind made up. She would go in search of her husband and his two comrades. There was little time, because they'd, what, a week's start on her? But if she could find a really fast-sailing Arab dhow in the harbour, and there seemed plenty of them about, to catch a following wind and take her into the delta, she could cut down that lead. The frown returned, however, as she lengthened her stride to get back to the hotel. The delta was a maze of channels. Which one to follow? Well, she would just have to tackle that problem when they reached there. Time was of the essence now. She strode to the reception desk at the hotel. "I'm going away for some time," she said, "but I'd be grateful if you could keep my room for me. My company in London will keep up the payments while I'm away, of course, and I would like to leave most of my possessions in it." The receptionist inclined his head.
"Of course, madam. That will be no problem. When will you be leaving, and can you let us have a forwarding address for you? For mail, of course."
"Well, I hope to leave tomorrow, or the next day at the latest. I have to make some arrangements first, you understand. I'm afraid I can't give you a forwarding address, so please keep my mail for me." She slipped a pound note across the counter, and the clerk accepted and pocketed it in one smooth movement.
"Of course, madam."
His eyes followed her as she began to climb up the stairs. Then he picked up the desk telephone and dialed a number. Cupping his hand over the mouthpiece, he said,
"Mr. de Villiers?" "Ah, yes, sir. I have some news that I think will interest you."
Alice changed very quickly into a simple khaki-coloured cotton dress, sandals and a pith helmet, and retraced her steps to the harbour, this time making for the smelly jetties where the fishing boats, large and small, were moored. She walked along slowly, inspecting each one with care. Then she found one that she felt might fit the bill. It was an Arab dhow, carrying a huge lateen sail that was now furled to its spar. Unusually, it had a small cabin amidships, with open holds for the catch and what appeared to be sailors' quarters in the forecastle. Three crew members were washing down the holds under the direction of what appeared to be the captain, a handsome middle-aged man wearing a clipped beard and a turban, his shirt undone to the waist, showing a muscular, dark brown chest. He looked up quickly at Alice and gave her a quick smile, revealing white, even teeth. It was not intrusive or disrespectful, merely cheerful. Alice did not respond but walked past, and then, from behind a tree trunk, inspected the boat again. She was rakish in appearance, with the gunwales sweeping down from a high prow and then up again to an equally high stern post. She certainly looked as though she would make the most of the capricious winds that characterized this part of the African coastline. To Alice's not altogether untutored eye, she looked a sleek, speedy craft, and one which, importantly, fitted easily into the environment. Turning back, Alice hailed the captain.
"Good morning," she said. "Do you speak English?"
The smile returned.
"Oh, yes, madam. I have sailed to London docks and back. I know your language."
"Splendid. May I come on board and have a conversation with you?"
The man's eyebrows rose.
"By all means, madam."
He issued a series of commands in Arabic, and a gangplank was thrown, bridging the gap between the boat and the jetty. He boarded it and walked halfway along and held out his hand.
"Be careful, madam. This is very slippy, I think."
Alice nodded and accepted his hand and strode purposefully across the plank, jumping down onto the narrow decking that bordered the open hold. She wrinkled her nose. If her plan came to fruition, she would have to live with this smell, probably for weeks. She coughed to hide her displeasure.
"Is there anywhere we could talk in private, Captain?" she asked.
"Oh, yes, I have a cabin."
He led the way, and they both bent to gain entry through the narrow companionway. The captain gestured to a narrow bunk which occupied one side of the cabin. She noted with approval that its blankets and sheets were carefully tucked and folded.
"Sit there, please. More comfortable. I sit on this silly little thing."
He tucked a small stool made of bamboo under his ample bottom and perched on it. Then immediately he stood again and leant forward, holding out his hand.
"I am Mustafa Abdullah. How do you do, lady?"
Alice clasped his hand and found that he had a firm grasp.
"How do you do, Mr. Abdullah?"
She sat back and regarded him quickly. His features were good, with wide-set brown eyes and high cheekbones.
"Mr. Abdullah, would you mind if I called you Mustafa?"
It was the name of a young Sudanese boy I knew many years ago and learnt to love very much.
"Of course not, madam. I am honoured."
He put his hand on his heart in an old-fashioned gesture and bent his head.
"Good. Now, Mustafa, may I ask if you own this boat as well as being its captain?"
The Arab inclined his head again.
"Yes, I am the owner. She is beautiful boat."
"So I noticed. That's why I decided I should talk to you. Now, Mustafa, my name is Alice Griffith. I'm married to a very senior officer in the British Army, and I am working for the British government."
Mustafa allowed his jaw to drop for a moment.
"You are working for British government. They let ladies do that in England."
Alice directed at him her most bewitching smile.
"Oh, yes, it's called intelligence work. In fact,"
she wrinkled her nose, "women are much better at this kind of work than men, you know." Mustafa shook his head slowly.
"The ways of Allah are strange, lady. But the ways of the British are even more strange."
His great smile returned.
"So then, lady, what can I do for you?"
She leant forward.
"Can I rely on your complete confidence?"
The Arab frowned.
"I am not sure what that means, madam."
"It means that I do not want any details of what I say to you given to anybody else, not even members of your crew."
He nodded his head.
"Certainly. No one will know."
He grinned. "Not even my three wives." Alice returned the grin.
"Mustafa, have you any reason to love the Germans?"
"No,"
he replied immediately and emphatically.
"They're too quick to whip people, I think. We have our honour and dignity as well as white people."
"Oh, that I know. Now, listen, I would like to hire your boat to sail to the Rufiji Delta in the south, in German East Africa, and then take me up the main channels in that delta. I don't know how long we'll be away, perhaps a month, perhaps more, but I do not want the Germans to know that you're carrying a member of the British Secret Service if we're stopped. So I must disguise myself. I am prepared to pay you handsomely for this, but I am in a hurry and would like to sail tomorrow."
He puffed out his cheeks.
"Ah, so soon. First I must sell my fish."
"Of course. How long would that take you?"
They already in market sell today, I think. Good catch this time, and... He paused. I must ask crew if they prepared to be away that long. Alice frowned.
It's important that you do not tell them where we are going until we are out at sea. You must need to tell them some story.
The captain wrinkled his brow now. This voyage is dangerous, you think?
Oh, I hope not. That's one of the reasons why I chose your boat. It's clearly a simple fishing boat.
Although, she smiled, to me it has beautiful lines and looks as though it will sail well. Mustafa's eyebrows shot up and his chest expanded visibly. Oh, yes, lady. The Khalifa is the best boat in Mombasa.
Now.
A serious look fell over his face. You say you pay well, so you must, because I lose all that time fishing.
Quite so.
Alice took a deep breath, mentally calculating the amount of funds she had available to her in the Mombasa bank, both from the Morning Post and from her own ample means.
I will pay you 600 British pounds for a month's sailing, she said. I will bring 300 with me to give to you tomorrow when we sail, and the rest when we return. If we're forced to stay at sea longer than a month, we must negotiate again.
Mustafa smiled, making his eyes dance.
He was comfortable, she reflected, conducting a bargain, like most Arabs.
Ah, madam, I think a little more. I could get very close to that with a good catch. Shall we say 700 British pounds?
No, we shall not. 650 will be my last word, 325 tomorrow, the rest on return. Now, Mustafa, if you don't take me, I must find another boat, so please, no further bargaining.
Slowly he nodded, his eyes still dancing.
Very well, madam.
He stood and leant forward, extending his hand. We shake hands like English people, yes?
Yes.
Alice smiled and made sure that the firmness of her grip now matched his.
We have a deal. Good. Now, what time can we sail tomorrow?
Ah, with this boat, we do not need a tide. We can row using big oars. I think you call them sweeps. Alice nodded. Yes, we can row out far enough to catch the wind beyond the harbour. So shall we say we sail soon after sun comes up? 6:30 by your watch.
Good. What about your crew? Do you need to find out if they will sail?
Mustafa's great grin returned. Ah, they will sail all right. Do not worry. They will agree when I tell them what I will pay them.
Damn, thought Alice, offered too much.
Well, never mind. Better to have a contented crew than a disaffected one. Her face became serious.
Remember, Captain, you must not tell them where we are sailing. If they reveal our destination, it will get back to the Germans very quickly, because Mombasa is full of spies. And then we could all be shot once we reach the Delta.
No, madam, not a word. I will not mention the German ship.
Alice shot him a sharp glance. I never mentioned a German ship.
No, but we look for the Königsberg, of course. Why else would we go to the Delta? She is there, I know.
Do you know where she's moored?
No, but we find her, lady. We find her. You can rely on Mustafa Abdullah.
Well, I do hope so. I will see you in the morning at first light, Mustafa. At first light.
At first light, madam.
Alice left the quay, her step light and her heart rejoicing. An adventure at last, with the possibility of an exclusive at the end of it, and, most important of all, the chance to join Simon. She smiled and turned towards the street market, which was a cacophony of sound and a kaleidoscope of colour, where the whole of Africa and his wife, it seemed, had congregated to trade and haggle. She headed straight towards a stall, which she had noted before, and which sold fabrics and garments aimed at the native market. She quickly selected a brightly coloured dress, another two-piece of a blouse and harem-style billowing trousers, native sandals, a selection of scarves, and a bad-weather Macintosh-type cape. Wrapping her purchases, she called at a stall that sold dyes, and then hurried back to the hotel. There she confirmed to the clerk at the desk that she would need no breakfast in the morning and would be leaving before dawn. She wished to cause no trouble to the night watchman, so would it be convenient, perhaps,
to slip out via the kitchen door, which she understood opened before dawn to receive early produce.
"Of course," agreed the clerk.
She smiled and hurried to her room. There she laid out her garments, tried them on to her satisfaction, and selected the trousers and blouse for wear in the morning under the bad weather cape. She then packed a soft hold-all with the remainder of the garments, underwear, toiletries, a water bottle, her malaria tablets, and anti-mosquito cream. Then she slipped in a heavy Webley service revolver and, as an afterthought, the small Belgian Francot automatic pistol, a snub-nosed weapon that could be easily strapped to her ankle under the billowing trousers without detection. She unpacked the dyes, selected one, and retreated to her tiny washroom to apply it all over her body. Finished, she regarded herself with approval in the mirror. Only the grey eyes seemed to regard her somewhat incongruously from the glass. She must remember to avert her gaze if questioned, and she must remember to spread paper over the pillow before retiring for the night. It was still dark, a humid, muskily scented night, when a dusky, rather tall native woman slipped out through the service door of the hotel and, head down under her headscarf, made for the harbour. All was a bustle aboard the Khalifa when she boarded her. Alice noted with relief that sleeping mattresses had been set out on deck above the forecastle. Obviously the captain had given her his cabin and thrown out the crew from their quarters to accommodate him. The sweeps were being produced and pushed into large rowlocks amidships, and Mustafa was coiling fishing nets and putting them into the holds. Good, they must look the part and obviously fish once they reached the delta. The captain raised his hand in greeting.
"Good morning, madam. I see you have converted to Islam. You look well. We are ready to sail. You have my quarters. I suggest you go there until we leave the harbour. The wives of fishing vessels here do not usually go with their husbands to sea."
"Very well, captain." Alice stepped inside the little cabin and laid out her things. She felt the boat lurch, gather way, and then move forward smoothly as the sweeps were manned. But she resisted the temptation to go on deck and see Mombasa retreat into the half-darkness. She, therefore, was not aware of the dark figure of Herman de Villiers, who stood on the jetty, partly shielded by a palm tree, carefully making note of the Khalifa's name as she swept out to the open sea.